hotel.
These presentations.
I'll let you know.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor to order May 23rd. Thank you, committee, for being here early on a Monday morning. I know it's not the most favorite time of the world. But we do have a couple of good presentations this morning. So we're going to start out hearing about youth employment. And then later on, we're going to talk about wage enforcement and misclassification of employees. So with that, I think we're going to start out with Nick Belichick from the Employment Department to talk a little bit about youth in the labor force, some trends, statistics, and whatever he decides we need to know.
Graphs, lots of graphs.
Yeah. We like visuals. Good morning, and if you would just introduce yourself for the record before you start.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Nick Blachick. I'm the state employment economist for the Oregon Employment Department. And this morning, I'm going to talk about youth labor force statistics, particularly with Oregon and across the U.S. This presentation is really an update of a report we published 2 years ago called Endangered Youth in the Labor Force. So we're going to take a look at what's happened since then. The background behind this report is the year before we had done a study on what has happened with overall labor force participation, which is the share of the population 16 years and older that's working or unemployed. They're actively looking for work, and that has dropped a lot in Oregon and the U.S. So we looked into the reasons behind that. A big part of that is aging of the population, retiring of the baby boomers. They're leaving the workforce. Of course, the recession meant a lot of people dropped out of the labor force when there wasn't work to be found. But a big and probably surprising part of that was there are much fewer young people participating in the labor force than there were a generation ago. And that trend had started before the recession. It started around the year 2000. So we decided to look into the details behind that. So that was 2 years ago. Since then, the economy has improved significantly. Oregon has been adding jobs faster than the nation for 39 months in a row. We added 64,100 jobs over the last 12 months, which is the largest gain in a 12-month period going back since comparable records have been kept in 1990. And Oregon's unemployment rate is 4.5%. That's the lowest it's been in 40 years, and it's actually lower than the U.S., which is kind of an unusual situation for Oregon. And the youth labor market has improved a lot, but it's still not great, especially for teenagers. So much of the data from, about half of the data from this report comes from a national or federal-based survey of households that's conducted every month. And so it includes about 1,000 households in Oregon. And then the results are averaged for a year to get the data for young people. And young people are broken out in the general, and I'll refer to them as youth, being 16 to 24 years old. Teenagers 16 to 19, and young adults 20 to 24. That's how the data is broken up and how you may hear me refer to them. For unemployment, remember the statistical definition for unemployed means a person doesn't have a job, but they want a job, and they're actively looking for work, and they're available for work. So this is important to consider, especially when we're talking about young people, because they could be in school and not have a job, but if they're not looking for a job, they're not considered unemployed. Or they could be in school, not have a job, but trying to find a job, then they're considered unemployed. And the definition for unemployment doesn't have anything to do with whether or not they're receiving unemployment insurance benefits. This has to do with them actively looking for work. So the unemployment rate for young people went really high during the recession. It's improved for both groups, but it's still really high, especially for teenagers. The line up the top shows the unemployment rate in Oregon for teenagers 16 to 19 years old. You can see that's still higher than it was before the recession, and it's higher than the national rate. The young adults, however, you know, their unemployment rate increased during the recession, improved. Now it's actually lower than the U.S., and it's about where we'd expect it to be during an expansion. So you can also see from this graph that it's pretty normal for teenagers and young adults to have a tougher time finding work than it is for older workers. And young people have an outsized impact on Oregon's unemployment rate. So teenagers are 3.5% of the labor force in Oregon, but they're 13.5% of the number of unemployed. And young adults are 8.8% of the overall labor force, but they're 13.5% of the unemployed. So this map just compares Oregon's youth unemployment rate, so 16 to 24 years old, with other states. The darker colored states have a higher unemployment rate, and Oregon ranks 17th, mm-hmm. and that's about equivalent to the overall unemployment rate ranking for Oregon last year. So one thing we found in our youth report is that the number of unemployed young people without previous job experience increased a lot during the recession. So the young people couldn't find work, so they weren't getting on the job experience. And where it used to be about 1 in 4 young people or teenagers who were unemployed didn't have previous work experience, it went up to over half of teenagers who are unemployed didn't have work experience. These are national figures. We don't have it for Oregon, but it's probably the same trend in Oregon. It's double the rate that it was 15 years ago. And employers are looking for workers that have previous experience. We hear that in our survey of employers. So young people without experience may not be getting their foot in the door for jobs that they'd otherwise be qualified for. So switching our statistic here to the labor force participation rate, that's the share of the population that's either employed or looking for work. Economists generally think of a higher labor force participation rate being better for the economy, you know, all other things considered. And that's the labor force participation rate is one thing that really separates this generation from previous generations. In the 1990s, when I was a young person, it was a lot more common for me and my friends to be working or looking for work than it is for teenagers today. So, for some reason, young people quit joining the labor force, and this happened well before the Great Recession started around 2000. Now, the labor force participation rate for young adults, it started to improve as the economy got better, but it's still about 10 percentage points below what it was in the 1990s. And the labor force participation rate for teenagers, so that's the bottom line, that kept going down. It started going down well before the recession, and it kept going down even as we started to see a strong job recovery.
So, quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, do we have any sense of why the because young people don't, you know, they don't want to work in the jobs that are available to them, or they can't find it, or, I mean, is it just anecdotal? You know, that's interesting.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nose, I'll have a little more on that later on in the presentation, but basically studies have shown, and we cover this in our report from 2 years ago, that young people are spending more time in education and school-related activities, but they're also competing with adults for the same jobs that were traditionally held by young people. So I'll have a little bit to show.
A little both.
So going back one slide, a little bit to that participation rate, the civilian non-institutional population, does that include or not include student workers, students that are working at universities and things like that?
Chair Holvey, this would include students working at universities. The civilian is not in the active in the armed forces. The non-institution means they're not in prison or they're not in a retirement home when we're talking about older workers or...
They're not educational institutions.
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
But I have a questions down there. Go ahead.
Sir, I have a question for or something for future discussion. I know in agriculture, going into the very fields and doing a lot of things on farms that used to be very, very much allowed and encouraged in the valley really got out of vogue after some of the safety changes went into place so that 18-year-olds could do things, but 16- and 17-year-olds often couldn't. So in the future, could we look at maybe historical differences between that 16- to 19 group as far as employability in ag and forestry-type jobs?
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, I think we have someone who can speak more to the regulation part of it.
Okay.
Coming up later, right?
Okay, thanks.
Representative Esquivel.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, how do you determine a percentage of people in this workforce if they are not on unemployment nor seeking jobs? How do you know what that population actually is?
Chair Holvey, Representative Esquivel.
There's no tracing of them.
These figures are based on a survey of households. So the U.S. Census Bureau calls up households and asks them about the people in the household and their employment situation. And so they're asking them, you know, who lives in the house, how old are they, are they employed? If they're not employed, are they looking for work? And that survey is done monthly, and it's the root of the overall U.S. unemployment rate.
It's a poll.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's this time for questions. You mentioned 64,000 new jobs over the last 12 months. Do you have an average salary or wage on that 64,000?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, from the survey that we get that data from, we know the number of jobs being added, and we know for the whole population what the average wage is, but we don't know the average salary of each of those individual jobs. When we look at it across industries, they're spread widely across industries that are relatively high paying and relatively low paying. So, basically, right now, a lot of industries are adding jobs fast. Some of them are relatively high-paying, like professional business services. Some of them are relatively low-paying, like leisure and hospitality. And we do have that, and that's something I can share.
Okay, thank you.
This is target for state, not target. So
comparing Oregon's labor force participation rate with the rest of or the other states, here darker means a higher labor force participation rate, which in general is a good thing, and Oregon's slightly high. It's ranked slightly higher for young people than the overall labor force participation rate is ranked. So it's pretty close to the national average. So now I'm going to switch data from a different source. We were talking about information based on a survey of household. Now we're looking at jobs, and so jobs being added that are covered by unemployment insurance. That's how we get the information. And then these are matched by the federal government to Social Security information that can identify the age of the worker. So it's a little different data source, a little bit different age groups, but pretty close to the same thing. And what we've seen is, although Oregon has added a lot of jobs, not a lot of those jobs have been going to younger workers. My data goes through 2015, so comparing 2007 to 2015, Oregon added 43,000 new jobs, but there were 29,000 fewer younger people working in the workforce. This graph shows it by age group since 1990. The bottom line is 14 to 18 year olds, the middle 19 to 21, and the top line is 20 to 24. And all those groups are below the employment levels from 2007. And this shows it by share of total workforce. So the percentage of employment in those age groups has dropped. So the percentage of total employment in those age groups has dropped. So it's becoming, young people in the workforce are a much smaller share of what they used to be. And then this is a graph I've been updating since the recession. This is the closest thing I have to the idea of a summer job. This measures the number of teenagers 14 to 18 who got a job with a new employer during July, August, or September. And so you can see it used to be much higher. Before the recession, over 40,000 people or 40,000 teenagers found a job during the summer months, and it dropped down to just over 20,000, and it's recovered a little bit, but it's not near what it was prior to the recession. And so, as a reminder, this would cover this counts jobs covered by the unemployment insurance program. It's not going to count jobs like babysitting, mowing lawns, you know, stuff teens could be doing for money, but it's not picked up by the statistics. And just a few of the industries most likely to be associated with younger workers. That top line shows food services and drinking places, so restaurants for workers 14 to 24, and nearly half, 45% of workers in that industry used to be young people in that age group. Now it's down to fewer than a third. So the middle line has food and beverage stores, and the bottom line is total for all industries. It used to be about 15% of the workforce were young people. Now it's about 11%. So what are young people doing if they're not working? A variety of studies in our report found that a lot of them are spending more time in school or in activities associated with school. This is a national graph that shows, the dark line shows the employment to population ratio of people who are enrolled in school, and you can see that's dropped, and even during the recovery, it's still kind of on a downward trend. But employment among those who aren't in school has started to pick up with the recovery. So that last 2 years of growth shows an uptick in employment for young people who aren't working, but still a downward trend for young people who are in school.
That's interesting.
And we created some forecasts of labor force participation rate for Oregon. These are based on national forecasts, so we applied that to Oregon's age groups. And we expect teenagers especially to continue this long-term decline in labor force participation. Overall participation rate will continue to go down, you know, especially with retiring baby boomers, but young adults will also see a slightly lower labor force participation rate.
Sure.
Question about that. Does the minimum wage increase play into this, and is that factored in?
Chair Holvey and Representative Kennemer.
Isn't it?
That's the next part I was going to talk about. So. Yeah.
Great. Get to it. Sorry.
His time's almost up, so he may not get to it.
Yeah, and
tell him you're kidding.
I'm kidding.
I thought he was serious.
The answer is we don't really know.
No.
So there,
like, it's not a factor.
There's a lot of research on this, and it goes either way. But a recent overview of 200 studies since 2001, the authors found that specifically looking at the question, does the minimum wage affect youth employment or labor force participation? They reviewed 9 academic studies that found it had negative results, 9 academic studies that found it had mixed results, like in some situations it might increase teen employment, in some situations it might decrease teen employment, 5 reports that found no significant impact, and there's even one 2013 paper that found it looked at one very large retailer with like 700 locations across the U.S., and they looked at states that increased the minimum wage higher than the nation and found that youth employment in those states tended to increase proportionate to all employment at that store. And the author concluded that is likely because young people were more likely to apply and try to get those jobs when the minimum wage was higher. Really way too big of a topic to cover in the time I have, but I was asked to look at other states, and this is pretty easy to do. Look at the minimum wage in all states and compare that with the labor force participation rate of young people, and there isn't any trend. Like, it's just not showing up or down. The U.S., of course, the minimum wage is $7.25. I put it in here as $8.50 because 29 states have minimum wages higher than the U.S., and only 39% of the U.S. labor force is covered by the U.S. minimum wage. So the rest of workers work in states with a higher minimum wage. So I tried to average that out to make the U.S. have a 780 to show where it stands in the rest of it. So that's the labor force participation rate, and Oregon shows up there good. And this is the same scatter plot, but with unemployment rates. So again, just all over the board, it looks to me from this scatter plot that the unemployment rate really has to do with other economic conditions rather than just the minimum wage. So thank you for letting me testify today. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Barreto.
I just had one. You kept referring to the reason that kids aren't working is because they're going to school. I know when I was going to school and a lot of other guys, you know, we were working while we went to school. And I'm wondering if part of that is because loans are so maybe more prevalent now, and kids, rather than working while they're going to school, are just taking out loans for their education.
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, that certainly could be. That's not something we were able to address when we dug into our report. We were looking at enrollments, credit hours, advanced placement exams, and discussion about sports, sports activities.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you, Nick. I appreciate you being here early on Monday morning. As usual, your information is always thought-provoking, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Gerhard. I can't ever remember how you say your last name, Pobble and Paloma Sparks, so I apologize if I mispronounce your last name.
That's okay. I'm used to it by my life.
Probably been called a lot of things, I'm sure.
Yeah, a lot worse. Good morning, Representative Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Gerhard Teubel. I'm with the Wage and Hour Division at the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
So I believe Paloma has provided you with a summary of the child labor laws for the state and some reference materials concerning questions that we frequently receive at the Bureau about child labor regulations and how they apply. So I don't think we propose to go into the details of the child labor laws, which can be very nuanced and can actually vary a great deal or depend a great deal on what kind of work a minor employee is doing. For example, there are a whole host of exemptions around agriculture. There are a whole host of exceptions and special permits for minors who are working in the entertainment industries. But what I do propose to do is just talk very generally about what the child labor regulations, what the purpose is of those regulations, and how BOLI enforces those and how they perhaps interact with federal regulations as well. One of the Wage and Hour Division's functions is to administer the child labor laws for the state of Oregon. The purpose of these laws is to protect the well-being of minors in the workplace. And basically, the child labor laws do this in two ways. One, they establish the kinds of work that minors can perform in the workplace. And second, they prescribe the hours of work that are available to minors in the workplace. Generally, minors as young as 14 years old are permitted to work. There are exceptions to that as well, where minors younger than 14 can work. But the baseline is for most types of work is typically 14 years of age. And the child labor regulations sort of break down or differentiate between 14 and 15-year-old employees and 16 and 17-year-old employees. So for 14 and 15-year-old employees, the prohibitions on the different kinds of hazardous work, work that a minor would not be permitted to perform, are more restrictive, whereas by the 16 and 17-year age, it's more broad categories which are prohibited, work in things like, you know, explosives or particularly dangerous types of equipment might not be allowed for a 16 or 17-year-old. In terms of the hours of work, whereas for a 14 and 15-year-old, the hours that are permitted, well, first of all, have something to do with when school is in session. They're more restrictive when school is on. In the summertime, they're more flexible. And there's a cap for the total number of hours that may be worked. For 16 and 17-year-olds, there's very little restrictions on the hours of work that are available. There's a 16 or 17-year-old can work no more than 44 hours in a week, but when they work, what time of day they work, is generally not restricted by the child labor laws. And the whole notion of sort of prescriptions for when minor employees may work has something to do with education and making sure that they're not spending so much time in the workplace that they're not paying any attention to their education or going to school or preparing themselves for the future in that way. State law largely mirrors federal regulations when it comes to the prohibitions in the workplace and what kind of work can be performed. So in enforcing the child labor laws, we're often looking at the federal regulations. One thing that the federal regulations do not do, which state law does, is it requires employers to come to the Bureau to obtain a certificate to employ minors. You may remember it used to be that minors would actually go get work permits when they wanted to get a job. This was done away with some time ago, many years ago, but what still remains is that the employers must come to the Bureau, submit an application letting us know what they propose the minors to do in their workplace, and then the Bureau reviews it. If there are any kinds of questionable, you know, work activities, we would speak to the employer about that to make sure that the type of work being proposed is allowed under the state and federal regulations before we would issue an employment certificate. On average, we issue over 3,000 employment certificates a year. It's somewhere, I think, around 3,500 a year to employers who are hiring minors in the state of Oregon. I can't tell you how that translates into a number of jobs because the certificate would apply to multiple minor employees, but that number, about 3,500 employment certificates, has remained pretty steady over the last several years. There is one category of student worker that does not fall under the employment laws or the child labor laws, and that would be a student intern, for example. And that is because if, as an intern, the student actually meets the criteria that has been set out in the regulations, they would not be considered an employee. For that reason, the child labor laws would not apply to the work that they do. So just, of course, just, you know, calling someone an intern does not mean that, you know, they're not an employee. They would have to meet the criteria that are established, which just very quickly, they're part of a training program that's been established. The training is for the benefit of the student more than it is for the benefit of the company that is providing the training. The trainees or students do not displace other workers in the workplace. The employer that provides the training is not getting any immediate advantage from the work that is being done. In fact, it may sometimes be burdensome to have the training there because this is meant to be a learning experience and not just another sort of workforce, you know, for the employer. The trainee or the student is not necessarily entitled to a job after the completion of the internship. And there's an understanding between the business and the intern that there will be no pay. This is an unpaid type of position. So student workers who fit these, or to whom these criteria apply, would not be considered employees. And for that reason, the child labor regulations would not apply to the work that they do. Paloma, did you have anything that you wanted to?
Not right now. Well, for the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I would add that some interns, while they are not employees, they do have some workplace protections under the civil rights laws. Not all of the civil rights laws apply to them, but many of them, particularly protections against sexual harassment, retaliation, do apply to interns. So they are not employees, but they have some employment protections.
Questions? That was a relatively quick description. I thought it was important for us to hear what those laws were about education. So I just have one question about the student interns. Is there a specific definition of the type of school that it is, or, you know, is school defined broadly?
Well, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, it is described rather broadly. It has to be something like the student would receive in a vocational type of setting. So some kind of instruction has to be going on, but it is not explicitly defined what that would be. But a school program, for example, that is teaching students about a job.
So there's some sort of degree program or
certainly
certificate or something they're trying to achieve in that definition?
Yes.
Chair Holvey, I also wanted to speak to Representative Evans' question earlier about agriculture. The primary limits on what a youth or minor can do in agriculture is limited by, I mean, the true limits are based on what is considered a hazardous occupation by the USDOL. But otherwise, it's pretty expansive what a minor can do in agriculture. Minors ages 12 and 13 can work outside school hours in jobs not declared hazardous as long as they have parental consent or their parents are working on the farm. 9 through 11 can pick berries and beans outside school hours as long as they have consent. And there's some other limits on that. Minors 16 and above can work at any job on a farm that's not declared hazardous. 14 and 15-year-olds can work outside school hours in jobs not declared hazardous. And they can also work longer hours in agriculture than they can in most other jobs. So it's fairly expansive.
Chair Holden, since there's a response to my question. Two points. One is, what's the definition of hazardous? Because combines to the squirrel that's in the way are hazardous, but I mean, so what's hazardous? And the second piece is the 44-hour limit that you said. Does that happen even during the summer? Because by Thursday, you're after. I mean, on a farm, you're already worked 44 hours. So, what's the hour limit? Are there exemptions for that? And at what age? And what's the definition of hazardous for farm?
Chair Holby, Representative Evans. With regard to what is considered hazardous, there are different categories that are established as being hazardous. None of those, I think, what Paloma was mentioning with regard to agriculture, for example, the operation of the equipment is hazardous under the child labor regulations. So miners are allowed to perform that kind of work. We do license it through the employment certificate process. That is, the employer would show us that the employees have received proper training to operate the equipment, for example. And with that kind of training, they would be allowed to do that work generally. With regard to the hours, 44 hours, that is true. It applies throughout the year. However, there are exemptions that an employer can apply for, again, through a special permit process to seek to employ minors for longer than the 44 hours per week.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was 13, I used to pick pears on a 16-foot ladder. And that was back in 1962 or 63, and I made $25 a day doing that, which is today equivalent to about $200. And that was a good summer job. Would you exclude me from that today?
Chair Hovey.
I would. Yeah. I would.
I couldn't get up the ladder, that's true.
But oh, man.
Sorry, but you set yourself up. I could not.
My friend over here. But is that considered hazardous today because it's on a ladder?
And I don't believe that the child labor laws would declare that to be hazardous. It may be, I don't know, under OSHA or some other kind of workplace requirements, whether that would not be permitted. But I don't think the child labor laws speak to that. I don't think they would prohibit that.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as far as hiring a miner, like if we hired a cleanup kid to sweep the floor, we would have to apply with BOLI before we hired that person? Is that the way I'm reading this? Or someone to clean the office or someone to do filing?
Yes, before an employer would hire a minor, that they would come to BOLI and submit a application for an employment certificate before hiring the minor.
Otherwise, you're outside the law?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that context. I think it's helpful for us, and I'm sure if we have further questions, we know how to get those questions to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we're going to switch gears just a little bit now that we have a little bit of background. As I guess I could have. Everybody can see the agenda. We're talking about youth employment today. So and youth work experience programs comes to mind in that discussion. And Karen Hummelbaugh is our next presenter from the Workforce Investment. She's the Workforce Investment Division Director from the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And thank you for working with us to put together a presentation on this. Appreciate it.
Right. Well, thank you, Chair Holvey. Again, for the record, my name is Karen Hummelbaugh. I work for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Thank you for having me here this morning. I'll try and roar through these slides a little bit, if I can figure this out. There we go. We want to talk about youth experiences for young people here in Oregon. There is a more comprehensive information in your packets from several of the groups that serve youth, and so I will not be covering all of that today. And we are going to be talking in particular about youth who may not find their way into a youth experience through a traditional, they just find it on their own, but assisting youth in finding that first job experience or youth experience. There are a number of boards and commissions and agencies that touch helping youth find work experience, and it is generally not the entire portfolio of any one organization. It is a piece of what they do. In particular, we have the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, and the Youth Development Council that all provide pieces of that puzzle. They are all governor and legislatively appointed bodies that utilize federal and state funds to provide the youth work experience as a piece of what they do. I'm not going to speak much to the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps because you'll have someone up here speaking about that in particular. In terms of the YDC, they provide a broad array of services for youth that go all the way from 6 to 24. So it's much more about educational success, crime prevention, engagement in the community, and not just specifically about work experience, although they have a small portion of their work that happens there. In terms of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, there is a mandate for those folks to do both youth and adult employment and training, and particularly in response to business and industry need that happens across the state. In order to do that, they provide money and guidance to 9 local workforce investment boards. Those happen around the state, sort of in economic areas, and those 9 boards are community-based. They're business-led. They are the place in which they are looking at all of the resources in the area and how those can be providing services for employment and training. In particular, when we talk about youth, they are serving out-of-school youth and connecting them to jobs and careers and work experience in a variety of mechanisms. We also have state agencies that assist with some summer works programs as a piece of their portfolio. In particular, Department of Human Services offers a work summer program that is particular to the folks who are on TANF, temporary aid for needy families. And there's also a vocational rehabilitation summer program that does something similar for a few youth in the summertime. And then I have this big community-based organizations, which I'll reference a few times, but there are many, many community-based organizations across the state that then assist in getting youth connected to those work opportunities. There must be a lot of collaboration in order to do this. You talk about all the different kind of pots of money and ways in which a person can access. And so there is collaboration, particularly for summer youth programs with the K-12 system, keeping young people engaged in the school system through summer opportunities so that they're staying there for sort of on-time normal graduation. Community colleges play a large role in this as well. There are sometimes actual work-study programs that happen on campus, as well as job opportunities or internships that happen through the business and industry connections. In particular, you think about the applied sciences and where those might be connected to businesses and opportunities might be available. All of this is linked, of course, to the career technical education pieces and making sure that we're meeting those industry demands as we get work experience for youth. I did add on Oregon Youth Authority. We're not talking in particular about people who are in the correction system or in and out of that, but it would be sort of remiss to not talk about the fact that when those folks are back in the community, it's important to connect them to some kind of work experience so they understand how that looks and feels to be employed and what that means in terms of their direction. So in terms of talking about connection to careers, youth experience might be connected directly to a career or a career ladder or track, and it also could just be showing the world of work in a way that connects you to careers in general or work in general. Many of these programs have a relationship directly to industry and business and where we know those demand occupations will occur. And so we're starting to get people through those CT and STEM programs thinking about and working in those industries and then connecting internships or summer jobs or other opportunities that way. This can also happen in terms of a pre-apprenticeship program that links you into a later apprenticeship program and work. There are also, we talk about soft skills development. This is something we hear from business and industry all the time. I know you guys have heard this a lot in hearings before. Soft skills development clearly is that whole piece about, can you show up for work? Do you know what you're doing there? Do you know how to stay engaged when you're there, work as a team? Really, the best way that we have found to make sure that people have that soft skills component is they have to experience what work is. So if you're not one of those people who mows lawns or babysits or works in the fields and those things you've referenced earlier in the hearing, And if your parents haven't taught you that through something at home, that's really something you need to learn. It's not something normally that can just naturally happen through like taking a test online or a course. That helps, but really having that employment opportunity is how you are going to learn those things. When we talk about summer work in particular, these are industry related, even when they're sort of in public service or in the parks. Those are still places where we will need workers. When we talk about healthcare or information technology, those are other places where there can be sort of entryway job opportunities. So the magic question for the day is, well, then how would you find one of these opportunities? What happens to a youth when they're looking for work? So there are traditional, some youth will just go in, look on a job board, go into a WorkSource Oregon office and actually find themselves a job. Think about the fact that we're talking about, generally speaking, although everybody has different age definitions, ages 16 to 24. So some people who are in this cohort of youth also would be what we consider an adult. So they might walk through a traditional adult mechanism to get into, to see what all of their opportunities are. There is no one door, and so I mentioned a few here. In addition to the WorkSource Oregon offices, there are multiple other state agency offices. Department of Human Services, is one where there are multiple offices across the state, which would also provide you with an entree into your opportunities for work. Obviously, community-based organizations, schools, technology is a big way in which you might hear about something. I actually, on my Twitter, follow many organizations that post their jobs or summer works opportunities, and I think that's a place in which young people are finding out about things. And I just added on quickly the old-fashioned way, but I think a lot of work opportunity is still sort of, did my neighbor experience that? I heard about this thing. Well, I know that this other kid got this job in the woods. How do I do that? And so there is still a large component of getting folks engaged in work that doesn't happen in one of those formal settings. When we're talking about approach, in order for an opportunity for work experience to be meaningful, we really need to make sure that we're tying the work and the learning together. That can happen in a number of ways. It can be informal or it can be formal. You talk about an apprenticeship program and that link to you have a job, but you're learning while you're on the job, or a pre-apprenticeship program, which teaches young people about how to get into that general direction. On-the-job training can happen in informal or formal ways in terms of there actually being a job and you're working towards it, or that you're receiving training in a particular industry. These can be cash or stipend. They can also be credit in some instances. Internships, again, short-term, long-term, a variety of ways in which that can happen, but the components include learning and wage. The other piece just to talk about is that we want to make sure we're documenting those individual skills, particularly if this opportunity is short-term, summer, or it is an internship for one term or something like that. There has to be a way for them to carry that on to their next employment opportunity or their career path. So we're talking about formal credentials and certifications that you might think of in terms of degrees or welding certification, those kinds of things, as well as there are a variety of smaller badges, some people call them, or just shorter term certifications where you're talking about maybe a soft skills certification. You showed up for work all summer long, you know, maybe that's something that's recognized, or maybe you've learned medical vocabulary and that's your first piece of working your career path in healthcare. So when we talk about investments in programs outside of you just went and found your own job, but you're going to hear from a lot of people who are paying for the wages for youth and making those connections to businesses, these are the kinds of programs primarily federal funded, although some have state funds or other funds that complement their program. Those program costs are generally stable and have not increased over time. And if you're talking about paying wages and looking for work and making those connections, obviously those costs are going up with inflation and minimum wage. Staying outside of the conversation where Nick was talking about sort of we don't know what minimum wage has the effect, but in programs where you pay the wage, it definitely has an effect in that we are going to be able to serve fewer youth with those dollars that we have that are essentially not going up or increasing. And so when we talk about that cohort that kind of hasn't caught up from the last recession and probably will be seeing some sort of at least dip in a recessionary way because they sort of happen on cycles, they may get left out again. Then you're starting to talk about overall lifelong earnings and tax base. And so this is a important topic in terms of getting folks involved in the labor force as soon as possible so they can experience it and then continue to earn over their lifetimes. That is my quick version of getting you sort of the opening of this work experience conversation. I'm happy to answer questions, or we can run into the programs that people are going to talk about.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought one of the pieces that you talked about was how job experience is critical to learning job skills. And I guess part of it is a lot of us have had concerns about the dramatic increase in the minimum wage and the impact this has on youthful workers. And there's quite a discussion going on about a training wage. And I'm wondering what you think would be the impact of such a thing.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer, like Nick mentioned earlier, I think it's a little too early and the jury is out in terms of how much the minimum wage is going to affect this entire system and the opportunities for youth. Certainly there are programs we have that provide a stipend instead of a full minimum wage. Most of them provide just minimum wage and nothing higher. And then there are sort of combinations of credit and wage. So I think that all of those things are certainly part of the portfolio that folks could explore as you're having that conversation about training wage.
So I was doing a little reading about the Career Pathways Program. Can you describe that just a little bit? Because I know a few community colleges are participating in that Career Pathways Program. I think it's a federal program, actually. But and does it have a stipend along with it or a minimum wage along with it? Or is it just depends?
Chair Holvey, the traditional career pathways that we actually Oregon led the way in terms of the 17 community colleges talking about what are career paths, what are sort of the chunkable pieces. So if your path is to become a registered nurse, what are all of the pieces? Maybe you're a medical technologist, maybe you're a CNA, then you become a registered nurse. Those are really less about work than they are about credit and working your way towards that. But the idea would be that you could be working at the same time and or working in between coming back and getting those opportunities. It's not necessarily a federal program. It's really individually based. Those are very developed at the community colleges here in Oregon. There is a discussion at the federal level, though, through our Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act dollars about are there sort of shorter versions of career pathway components that might not be so formalized in a credit program through a college.
So that's a conversation the Workforce Investment Board is.
That would be fantastic, Chair Holvey.
Talking about. Any other questions for Karen? Thank you, Karen, for giving us that overview. I appreciate it. Up next, I'm going to switch the order that appeared on the schedule a little bit, agenda. I'd have Steve Sims and Andrew McGaw will be my two next presenters. You thought you were going to wait till you were going to be last, huh?
Yeah. Just jot down all my notes.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Good morning.
Along with, if you could just introduce yourself before you start.
Certainly. Good morning, Chair Holvey, Representative Stephen Sims, the Administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Andrew McGough, I'm the Executive Director of Work Systems, which is the Workforce Development Board for the City of Portland, Washington, Multnomah County.
Thank you. Thanks. If I may, I believe since my presentation is up there, I'm going to switch places with Andrew real quick here.
That's right.
I don't think he has the proper credentials for running that anyway.
Mr. McGaughan knows quite a bit about apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship, but I will take this one over. I'm going to make a clarification right up front and state that
Pre-apprenticeship in Oregon and in most states is not necessarily a youth program, and it's not necessarily an employment program. It is a preparation program. There may be, and there are in Oregon, a few pre-apprenticeship programs that do pay a stipend of sorts. But these programs are targeted primarily at incumbent workers looking to transition into new jobs or to enter the construction or manufacturing industry. What would be interesting, and what we're collaborating with both the Employment Department and the Department of Education, is looking at ways to take some of our career and technical education programs, partner them with industry, and build to pre-apprenticeship programs that easily transition people from school into work. Oregon has had pre-apprenticeship programs approved by the State Apprenticeship Council since 1992, long before the United States Department of Education first issued any type of guidelines on pre-apprenticeship in 2014. All pre-apprenticeship programs must be approved by the State Apprenticeship Council. That's the body that supervises our operations. And that's not going to work. Basically, a summary of pre-apprenticeship. The best way to think about it is a boot camp, an industry-based boot camp for people looking to enter into an apprenticeable occupation or trade. In Oregon, about 78% of our apprenticeships are in the building and construction trades. The remainders are in the utility occupations and in manufacturing. This is a way to get people ready. It's kind of preparing them for entry into an apprenticeable occupation. A pre-apprenticeship program has some real basic components. There must be a soft skill training component. A lot of the pre-apprenticeship programs approved by our office work with people who are economically disadvantaged or have never had any experience in the construction or manufacturing trades. Some of them have very little work experience. So the key is to develop soft skills so they know what they're doing once they get to a job site. The second component is classroom instruction. Construction and manufacturing are both heavily math-based, so there's a lot of instruction in basic shop math, basic industrial math. There is also a requirement that there be a hands-on component. Individuals need to know the basics. Our apprenticeship programs can teach them what to do actually in a job situation, but they need to know the basics of how to handle tools, safety, and the like. If in a pre-apprenticeship program, in order to be approved, it must have a partnership with an approved adult apprenticeship program. An adult apprenticeship program must look at that full scope of curriculum and say, we like what they're doing, we approve what they're doing, and we will give them some sort of facilitated entry into our apprenticeship program. Facilitated entry can mean anything from complete this pre-apprenticeship program and you get to enter directly into the front door, we'll find an employer for you. It can mean putting you on the bottom of an out-of-work list. Once all the other apprentices who are currently in the program have found work, you might go to work. You might get extra points in the applicant evaluation. You might get an early interview, or you might get credit for the skills you learned in pre-apprenticeship. But that connection between an existing adult registered apprenticeship program and the pre-apprenticeship program is the key, because we want a pathway so that people just don't spend 8 to 12 weeks of their time learning these skills. We want the industry to say we accept these skills and we're ready to take folks in. As I said earlier, most of the programs last between 8 to 12 weeks, except for some of our high school programs and Job Corps programs. The Job Corps programs can last from 1 to 3 years. The high school programs can last up to 2 years because they're embedded into the high school curriculum. Again, this is about preparing students and people looking to get into the apprenticeship trades, and it's about creating a career pathway for them. I'm not going to read all of those for you, but the next two slides are a list of the current pre-apprenticeship programs in Oregon. Just to pick to note a couple of them, the Cascadia Technical Academy was once known as the Clark County Skills Center in Vancouver, Washington. They've been a great source of applicants for apprenticeship programs over the years. The construction-related employment for women program is a program run at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facilities, specifically looking with women in the last 2 years of their incarceration to transition into trades opportunities. Mm. Are probably the programs that, that turn the most individuals out in, and into apprenticeship programs or are the Oregon Tradeswomen and Constructing Hope. Those are both programs located in the Portland metropolitan area. Oregon Tradeswomen specifically works with women, and Constructing Hope primarily works with individuals who have exited the correction systems and now are attempting to learn a trade. And as I mentioned earlier, you'll see Job Corps up there. Most Job Corps programs that have either construction or manufacturing tracks are approved by the state as pre-apprenticeship programs. Just to talk a little bit about the operation of these programs. Most of these programs are either industry funded. You'll see there is a program up there that's run by a carpenter's apprenticeship program, a laborer's apprenticeship program, and an IBEW apprenticeship program. They pay for the complete operation of those programs on their own. They partner with community-based organizations and local workforce boards to try to find applicants who might be deserving of the opportunity, but they pay for that by themselves. The programs that are administered by high school and community colleges, this is where a career pathway or a course of study in construction or manufacturing is already embedded in that school, and they have then worked with the apprenticeship programs in their area to say, how can we successfully transition people to you? The programs operated by nonprofits have had the longest history of success in moving participants towards apprenticeship, but they also struggle the most because they are nonprofits and they depend upon donations and grants to continue operation. All of these programs, regardless of who the operators are, must offer some form of supportive services to help their applicants once they, I'm sorry, their participants, once they complete their program, transition into apprenticeship. So that supportive service can be anything from helping them find their first job to making sure they have the necessary tools, equipment, supplies in order to work, to having mentoring and counseling services for the applicants. There are no age limitations with respect to youth apprenticeship. Since this is a discussion of youth employment, some of our apprenticeship programs do manage to find employment opportunities embedded into the program. If a nonprofit is operating a pre-apprenticeship program and they find out that another nonprofit is doing a demolition on a job, a Habitat for Humanity house, for example, they might be able to figure out a way to pay a stipend. The IBEW program that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago has a two-week component where participants will work for a contractor as a helper for 2 weeks just to get them some true working experience. But there aren't a lot of work paid work experiences that come as a part of the pre-apprenticeship program. Eligibility requirements are fairly minimal and vary upon the target audience. For most of the programs that serve adults, be over the age of 18. If you need a GED or a driver's license, they'll help you with that. The youth programs vary by school and also by the apprenticeship committee that's working with them. Those apprenticeship committees usually work with the school district to develop basic initial criteria for entry into the program. We believe that pre-apprenticeship is really a great way to create a network, for a two-way network. The industry is looking for ways to bring people in an organized fashion, people who have some basic knowledge, understanding, some work skills, and particularly with respect to schools, they're looking for ways to transition people into these opportunities. So we're looking at expanding the use of pre-apprenticeship to create a pipeline for these occupations. We've been working with the Employment Department and the Department of Education to incorporating basically pre-apprenticeship, registered apprenticeship into the state workforce and education systems. We believe this can be a smooth continuous process. We just have a lot of moving parts that we need to coordinate. That means greater coordination with our local WIBs. The local WIBs have youth programs, for example, who might have applicants, participants trying to find the right place to go. Youth pre-apprenticeship could be a great path for them to follow. From working with pre-apprenticeship programs, particularly the private nonprofits, they need a stable source of funding. Again, they're grant-based primarily. They do get donations. Some of the apprenticeship committees are able to support them financially, but they do live kind of a hand-to-mouth existence. We need to continue to strengthen support for career and technical educations to make that pathway easier for students to transition through the position. And we need to continue to do outreach to employers to get them to invest back and say, the pipeline is here, there are components here. Will you work with us to make sure we're getting you the applicants that you need? So that's a summary of pre-apprenticeship in Oregon. I'd be happy to take any questions before turning it over to Andrew.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said no age limitations in here. So do they, if they're an apprentice, do they have to basically be under the same requirements that BOLI has for minors that are working?
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto. Most apprenticeship programs will allow individuals to apply to their program at the age of 17. They cannot get a, if they're in a licensed trade, they can't enter the registered program until they're 18. So it's 18 for the apprenticeship program. But with respect to pre-apprenticeship, particularly the high school-based programs, since they probably won't be engaged in working, there's no age limitation there. It's whatever the career and technical education requirements are for that school to participate in a structured career and technical education program. For the programs that primarily serve adults, they just need to be 18 and able to work.
Okay. Can I have a follow-up? Mm-hmm. Soft skills now has been mentioned a couple times. Can you give me your definition of soft skills? Because it seems to be kind of a little bit fuzzy.
Representative Barreto, Chair Holvey, there are a lot of ways to say soft skills, and I think it covers a broad range. I know that one of Representative Holvey's associates used to say they need to be able to show up and make fog on a mirror, which is true to a point, because the ability to show up to work, the ability to speak properly, the ability to know how to take direction, how to take order, how to take care of yourself and stay healthy at work. What we're finding from our apprenticeship program is that a lot of people just don't know the basics of being a responsible worker. So a lot of that soft skills is just knowing that a job is a privilege and that you have some obligations that you need to fulfill.
Thank you. And just to clarify, Steve, when you were speaking of the pre-apprenticeship programs, they don't normally have compensation with them, but the apprenticeship programs do.
That every apprenticeship program must have a payment.
Right. And then final, I know there has been conversations at some points. I don't know if they're still continuing or going on, but there was a lot of discussion about academic equivalency credentialing for these career pathways with community colleges, or you know, somebody going through an apprenticeship program could also be working on a degree at the same time. Is there still conversations on trying to figure out what that looks like, that whole equivalency issue?
Chair Holvey, yes, and there are. There are now career pathways and degrees embedded within the community college system for individuals registered to an apprenticeship program, a registered apprenticeship program, that they're going to get academic credit, and at the completion of their apprenticeship, if they take an additional 12 hours of general ed, they would qualify for an associate's degree. The work that's going on now is moving back from that community college piece and say, how do we take our high school CTE programs and maybe create a 2+2 system so that maybe some of that credit that's being earned in high school in a CTE program or a career study that matches the apprenticeship occupation, how do they get some credit in high school that can be carried into the community college? And then as a part of the apprenticeship program, that individual gets out faster, and they have the credential, their associate's degree as a credential, as well as their journey card.
Great. I'm glad to hear that's still moving forward. Don't see any other questions. We'll go ahead and thank you very much, Steve. Andrew, you introduce yourself for the record.
Thanks, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name, again, is Andrew McGough, and I'm the Executive Director of Work Systems, and we're the Workforce Development Board for the City of Portland, Washington, and Multnomah Counties. I'm here to talk briefly about a program that we run. It's a work experience program that we call Summer Works. This program actually started in 2009 through a grant we received through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And at the time, we served about 1,350 kids with that grant. And as an aside, I would just say that those grants were available across the state of Oregon. And so these kinds of summer jobs programs have been done across the state. There's expertise out there. There's infrastructure out there. The real question is there resources out there to make these things happen? But when we did it in 2009, it was such a success that my board and our community really encouraged us to try and figure out how to make this thing a continuing, sustainable effort of our organization. And so the next year, which was 2010, we were able to secure resources to support about 213 kids. So a dramatic reduction, but a continuation nonetheless. And I'm proud to say that this year our goal is to serve 1,000 kids. So we've moved back up, we continue to see more and more partner organizations that are working with us to figure out how to do this, how to bring it to scale. Something else I provided you today was a study that we recently did on what is termed disconnected kids. So those are kids that are neither connected to school nor work, youth between the ages of 16 and 24. And what this report found, which was startling to the folks in our region, was that there are more than 30,000 young people between the ages of 16 and 24 in the Portland metropolitan area who are neither connected to school nor work. So it's an enormous challenge. We're guessing that there are a few kids in there who are, you know, enjoying a gap year or doing something else. But the reality is most of those kids are struggling to connect either to school or work, and it's a big challenge. Something, too, I would just want to point out, when Nick went through the statistics, I mean, you saw that we're seeing some improvement, which is great. But if you disaggregate those numbers and look at low-income kids or kids of color, the challenge in those communities are just extraordinarily big. African-American males in certain neighborhoods in Portland, only 12% of those kids who want to work are actually working. So that's a big, big issue, and it's a place where I think our board, our community, our state needs to start, you know, thinking a little bit differently about. But the summer program, so over the course of these 7 years now, we've served 3,777 youth. We've had an extraordinary level of satisfaction conveyed to us by both the kids who participate in the program and by the industry who support the kids or, you know, offer work sites for them to participate on. It's been just an amazing positive experience all around. I mean, you hear this mythology about, you know, today's kids don't want to work or they're incapable of working. Our experience doesn't say that. It says that these kids really do want to work and that when they get an opportunity, they take full advantage of it and they do a really great job when they're there. About 90% of the organizations who support kids have consistently said it's been a positive experience. They want to share it with their colleagues, and they market it to others in the industry that they know. So, you know, again, it's having these residual benefits outside of just teaching those soft skills and just the opportunities to work. It's helping companies figure out ways how to better relate to these younger workers and how to help their frontline supervisors supervise these people in a more effective manner. So there's all these sort of residual benefits that I think we lose, you know, just on the fact that it's a summer job. Last year, We had over 41 different funding organizations. Obviously, we're mostly reliant on federal and local funding. Multnomah County has stepped up in a really, really big way. We are very fortunate to have Commissioner Loretta Smith is on my board, and she's an enormous proponent of services to youth, and she's been a huge advocate and has used her Rolodex continually to engage employers and, you know, challenge them to come to the table, and they've stepped up as well. So Multnomah County, Washington County, but we're increasingly getting more private sector contributions. Again, about 41 different organizations, about 75% of that would be private sector. School districts, Portland Public Schools, Hillsborough School District are now really fully engaged partners in this effort. Department of Human Services, I saw Dan here, they've become a really good partner in this. So, you know, we're piecing it together, and it's really helping us bring this to scale and also creating, you know, I think the kind of coordination that you really need to do this stuff in an effective way. I mean, something that I think is really important to think about here is the reason we stuck with the summer program is because we thought it could be complementary to the educational enterprise. You know, kids aren't going to school in the summer months. It's not really in their wheelhouse. And our thought was, well, the schools have enough to do. If we could figure out a way that we can be complementary to them and do it in a way that allows them to access the service as well as, you know, our other community-based partners and whatnot, it really does create the kind of synergy and the efficiency that we need to bring these things to scale, because you can't have hundreds of different organizations calling up employers and saying, hey, you know, give my guy a shot. You have to figure out how to organize this in a way that not only works for the kids, but it also works for the employers. It's got to be efficient, it's got to be effective, and it's got to be clear what the expectations are for the employer on the back end. So what the experience is, kids get 180 hours of work experience, so typically you'll work about 30 hours a week over a six-week period. How we get kids involved is we work with community-based organizations, schools, and others, and so we go out to youth-serving organizations, and we tell them about the opportunity, and then they refer kids to an online application, which we manage, which, again, is scalable statewide. So kids come and apply, and then those referring organizations do the prioritization. They say, yeah, of the kids who applied, these are the ones we think you ought to look at, because this year we had 2,500 applicants out of those community-based organizations and educators for 1,000 slots. So there's far more demand than there are resources to serve these kids. And again, if you look at the bigger numbers, it's even, you know, more challenging to figure out who gets these spots. But once we select the kids, they go to a week-long work readiness training. It's a curriculum that was nationally recognized. It's been a best practice across the country. It emerged out of an organization in Baltimore. But kids go through that. It takes about a week for the kids to go through that, and then they have one-on-one sessions, and then we finally pick the kids out of that session. So our goal is to send kids who are ready to go to work, and then we try and match them up to those employer opportunities where they have interests. And just on the CTE side, increasingly, we're able to connect kids to opportunities in our targeted industry sectors. The last go around, we had about 20 organizations who are either manufacturing, high tech, or construction related organizations that took on these kids. So we're able to make those connections and get real world work experiences so that when they go back to the classroom, they understand that connection between earning and learning. And, you know, frankly, motivated to learn more because they know they'll make more money. And there's opportunities there. So finally, on the policy end, you know, people have been talking about the impacts of minimum wage today and this question of a training wage. Representative Kennemer, I think it is something to think about. So the cost to do this right now is $3,200 a kid. The vast majority of that resource goes to paying wages for the kids for those 180 hours. We pay minimum wage. So if you took 100 kids, this year, we'd only be able to serve 91 next year. And by the time the full implementation of the minimum wage comes in 2022, we'll only be able to serve 75 kids with the same amount of money. So that's a quarter fewer kids down the line. So that is a challenge. It's something that I think we need to figure out. Again, that could either be through a training wage, which I think is worth considering. You know, some of the questions around BOLI and how we might fit into the definitions that were talked about earlier today on the educational side, I think might be worth considering and maybe looking at that language. Our folks right now say, no, we're not ready to do that. But that may be an opportunity. And I think just a state investment could potentially help offset some of those losses. So that's our summer works programs, and I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm running just a touch behind schedule, but I did want to ask one question. It dawned on me as you're describing the coordination with other programs, with other agencies. Is there work being done, like with the employment department or community colleges or K-12, you know, is somebody putting together a list of all the other potential, you know, at least all the programs that, you know, youth could look at, or, you know, opportunities, how they get, I understand how they get access to your program, but is there like a referral, you know, here's a list of all the programs, you know, that are available to youth in this area? And because I know in the workforce arena, generally, or the workforce investment boards, they're looking at targeted sector or industry sectors as opposed to just in general.
Yes. I mean, coordination is the key because there is a lot of activity out there. And we see that as an essential role that a workforce development should provide, is to know what programs are out there, which are most appropriate for kids. You know, as I mentioned, we get 2,500 applicants. We don't like to say no. We have to say no because we don't have the resources specifically for those jobs. But we really go out of our way, because if we know a kid wants to work, but there's not an opportunity this go around, what are other alternatives that we might be able to connect that kid up to, so that they're, you know, looking down the line at opportunities moving forward or taking advantage of whatever's there. So yes, coordination is key, and I think that's a role that we're happy to play on behalf of the various systems out there.
Thank you, Representative Doherty.
And this is just a comment. I don't know if it was working with your group, but Youth Source and Tigard has placed some kids. I got some very, very, very small businesses, like one- or two-person businesses, to hire some of these kids in kind of a joint, you know, program. And they were very impressed with the training, especially with what we call the soft skills that the kids had. And a lot of these were minority kids out of the Tigard area that had never had a paying job before, and it not only boosted their self-confidence, but it was also a very good program for the small businesses. So I compliment you.
Thank you.
If not, keep going.
Yeah, no, it was us. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, we compliment both of you for all the work you do.
Yeah, thank you.
For our workforce. Appreciate it. So we'll take a look at a couple other programs youth may access. Jeff Parker from the Northwest Youth Corps. And I also have Kathy Kinsella coming up, and Tony Frazier. Good morning, and customary if you just introduce yourself before giving us your presentation, and thank you so much for being here to talk about your programs.
Yep. Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Parker. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Youth Corps. Do you want to do introductions all the way?
Just go ahead and I'll introduce I'll just as jump they in. Come up.
I think I'm driving here. So as Karen had mentioned earlier about the community-based programs, Northwest Youth Corps is exactly one of those community-based programs. I'll give you a brief introduction and then talk a little bit about our compensation models, which I think is germane to this conversation. What do I do here? Enter. There we go. So this is our 35th year of taking young people into a work experience where really what we're doing is trying to provide them opportunities to be successful. We want them to learn. We want them to grow. We're not necessarily going to define what success is, but for this conversation, success is about employability downstream. We have a couple of different models. We work with both a youth population, which we define as 15 to 18 years old. And for our youth population, it's a time-bound five-week program. They usually operate from April through October. And we have both residential, meaning young people are camping in remote parts of the state doing conservation work, and then community-based programs where young people work Monday through Friday but get to sleep at home at night and stay home on the weekends. Some of the critical pieces to each of those programs, whether it's camping or not camping, excuse me, is that there's a conservation service piece, so we're doing critical conservation work. There's an education curriculum that everyone's involved in, and it's accredited, and that there's a recreation component to it as well, so that the young people are learning soft skills. I would also add grit and perseverance to the soft skill list as we're making that list. Gaining leadership skills, becoming workforce ready. At the end of that five-week experience, the youth get a paycheck. They get an academic credit, so a credit and a quarter of high school credit. But they also have that adventure. They build friendships. They have a sense of service and, most importantly, a better understanding of what citizenship is. If we move over to our young adult programs, these we define are 19 to 26 years old. And so we do those in two flavors. We have a short form and a long form. Again, both residential and non-residential opportunities. But really what we're talking about is that 8.8% of young adults in the state that are not workforce ready. They're underemployed or unemployed. And so they're defined federally as opportunity youth. They're disconnected from higher education, and they're disconnected from the workforce. Our goal with them is to provide them with industry-recognized credentials, to give them work experience, to put them on a pathway to success. And so for us, that means not only putting a paycheck in their pocket, but also getting them an AmeriCorps education award that they can use to either pay back student loans or use for future tuition. So we want young people to walk out with a resume that actually reflects substance. The industry-recognized credentials that we talk about are S-212 chainsaw certification, which is a federal recognition, 130-190B firefighter certification so that they're ready to go work on a fire crew. Some of them get herbicide applicator licenses. They all get a wilderness first aid certification. Whether they're with us for 8 weeks or 20 weeks, they also all walk away with that education award. The way that we look at compensation for both our youth and then our young adults is that they're both education programs. So our youth come there, they get anywhere from $250 to $300 a week for their work, but most importantly, they get that 1.25 credit for high school. And some of our youth participants also get a scholarship award, whether it's through the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps or whether it's through our federal AmeriCorps grant. And then with our young adult programs, they get a living allowance just under $1,300 a month. They get the education award, the scholarship, and then the training and the credentials that go with it. So I think what's really important about this as a community-based partner, we look at work experience and service as very different than a job. And some of the key differences are that these are time-bound, limited-duration experiences. We're not wanting to be an employer of record for long term. We want to deliver them to the workforce ready to be successful. There's a benefit to the participant, so they come here to get the experience. There's a benefit to the partner that we work with. A lot of times that's the BLM, the Forest Service, OPRD, Fish and Wildlife. So we're doing community work, work for the partner. And then there's the benefit to the community, both our recreational infrastructure is being improved and we have young people that are getting ready to enter the workforce. The community partnerships are what make this work. There's a value way beyond the paycheck for these young people. Our hope is that the soft skills, the grit, the perseverance, the teamwork, the empathy, all of those things that they learn while being on a committed crew of 10 young people just like them gets them ready to be successful not only in the workforce but secondary education and to manage their family affairs and all of the stressors that are headed towards them. And some of the authorities that we work under, so for our youth youth training, there's six exemptions in the Fair Labor Standards Act, and many of them are exactly the same exemptions that are the BOLI criteria for internship and employment, with the exception of the last one, and it has to do with compensation. But those those exemptions have to do with who benefits from the experience, and it has to benefit the youth. It can't benefit the employer or the organization. So that's one of the authorities that helps us do academic work in a workforce environment. And then the other with our young adults is the National Community Service Act, also known as AmeriCorps, followed up by the Kennedy Serve AmeriCorps Act, which is a reauthorization of that bill. And so that it is a statutory exemption from Fair Labor Standards Act for AmeriCorps members. They're recognized as service, time-bound, limited duration members. They're, the word employee never comes up there. And I think that for the service work that organizations like Northwest Youth Corps do and many of the organizations in the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps portfolio, it is about service. It's about member development. And I'm really excited about a conversation that can happen in this realm about Oregon taking a leadership role in that to mimic some of the authorities that are provided at the federal level to engage more young people. And just like Andrew had mentioned before me, we serve about 1,000 young people a year. Well, we as well have 3,000 applicants, and so that means there's 2,000 young people we're saying, we're sorry, we don't have capacity for you right now. And part of it is the limitation of those partnerships.
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate that. Just a real quick question about are there any specific requirements for youth to access your program other than, and they do an application, and if you have slots available, how do you, I mean, does any kind of youth or able to access your program?
Chair Holvey, that's a great question. So it's open enrollment for us. There's no eligibility requirement in terms of their background. Really, the hardest thing for us is to get the word out. If we're looking to target a particular community, as an example, we have a American Sign Language program where we're taking deaf and hard of hearing young people into this environment. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of community work we have to do to reach that community and build trust. But otherwise, if there's a young person out there that wants this opportunity, we want to provide it for them.
Thank you. Great. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and committee members. My name is Kathy Kinsella, and I'm here today as the immediate past chair of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. Unlike some of the programs we've heard from today, we do not work directly with the youth. We provide grant funding to programs throughout the state. And our goal is to fund a program in every county in the state. We operate under ORS 418.650 with the general purpose of establishing a work program for at-risk youth that is tied into natural resource education and developing career opportunities for those youth in the future. And that goes to finding out what you don't like as much as what you really want to do with your future career path. So we may have a program that has youth out building trails, and that youth says, never again, I'm going to continue my education and go into medicine or something similar. So the programs that we provide grant funding to typically are under two specific grant areas. One is the Summer Conservation Corps, and this is really a paid work experience for the youth. They are paid to show up on time. They build those soft skills through this work experience, and in some cases, it's the first time they've ever been in a work experience where they had to communicate with other workers, where they had to become a team member, where they had to accomplish a task in a set amount of time, and this provides them that opportunity. In some cases, the summer programs also provide some academic credit to help further their high school work. And then the second one is primarily the Community Stewardship Corps, which is more of a year-round program or a school year program. And in some cases, the youth are paid a stipend or a wage. In some cases, not. It's just academic credit. And what we're seeing as a trend in the programs that apply for these grants is not only are the youth earning high school credits, but they're also oftentimes earning college credits as well, which will help them move forward. In addition to that, they earn scholarship dollars. It's a requirement of the guidelines that each program pay into a scholarship fund for each participant based on their time in the program. We also have some planning grants that are available for programs who are thinking about starting but aren't quite sure exactly where that will go. And then we have partnerships and collaborations with other funding streams such as the Marine Board and Bureau of Labor and Management. In 2005, the Summer Conservation Corps, our funding purchased, if you will, 55,172.4 hours of labor from the youth. And those were youth who were out in the forests and working with ODF&W, working with Jeff, working with some of the other partners in the community. In 2016, our Summer Conservation Corps dollars will purchase less than 43,000 hours due to the minimum wage increases. So it will have an impact on our funding. OICC is funded from the lottery amusement device tax, which is stable but flat. So we're always looking for additional partners who come with funding, and we're looking at new and innovative ways to bring money into our program. In 2015, the average Summer Conservation Corps grant that you could receive as an applicant would be $11,111.11. And that went out to all of the 36 counties for programs operating in those areas. The CSC grant average was $19,047.62, and only 21 grants were issued at that point. But this particular grant is not enough to run a program. So all of the programs out there are looking for additional funding. They're looking for additional partners. They often partner with WIOA, the Independent Living Program through Department of Human Services. They have partners, Title III funds, Title II funds, all of those areas. The programs are looking for private foundations to bring in additional monies to support their programs. Their project partners typically bring additional staff, they can bring transportation, they bring tools and safety trainings, and probably the most important part to me, formerly I was a workforce development supervisor for WIA programs, and I ran the youth program. So I get this. I know what you have to do to pull a summer program together or a year-round program together. And one of the most important parts for me was in working with my partners from the Forest Service or BLM or ODF&W or even the county or the cities involved in my little community, was the exposure of the youth to different occupations and the opportunity to sit and talk with a wildlife technician and to figure out what kind of education do I need in order to pursue that kind of an occupation. Where can I get that education? Where can that education take me? And so that exposure to different occupations is huge in this whole program. In addition to learning the soft skills, you know, then you also expose them to career opportunities and how and where to find those. The other part that I think is really important that OICC plays is a crew leader can make or break your program. And so you need to have responsible crew leaders who know what to expect from what are considered at-risk youth and sometimes are a challenge just to be around on a daily basis. So that crew leader needs to be prepared, and OICC provides crew leader trainings as well as information on how to motivate the youth and how to keep your partners happy to make sure that the work is accomplished, so forth and so on. I'm not going to talk too much about the programs that I ran, but the things I encountered were funding issues, were how to keep the crews motivated, especially the year-round crews. There's a point where it comes right around the holidays, and the crews all just go, oh, well, I'm not coming to work today. And so how do you keep them motivated, and how do you keep them moving forward? And OICC is great at providing some motivational techniques for that as well. The issue for me was always turning away those that apply because you don't have enough funding to hire everyone. But those who do go through the program experience a life-changing opportunity, and they use their scholarship dollars to continue into their education and to follow their career path. And maybe they didn't have a career path before going through this program, but they find out what they wanted to do and what they didn't want to do. In closing, I just wanted to say that the OICC's mission statement is to create meaningful opportunities for youth through significant resource projects that enhance the Oregon community. As a part of the OICC grant application, the youth are required to complete a survey at the end of the program. And to me, these statements tell it all. So I'd just like to read a couple of statements from the youth who have made these comments at the end of their program. I learned how to work as a team. I learned about job safety and first aid. I learned responsibility, communication, and time management. I learned that finding my passion is more important than letting others decide my future. And the most important thing I learned was that nature always needs to be examined by humanity in order to see where we are going in life and if we are being good stewards of our lands. I've had an annual report passed out to each one of you. The pictures tell the story, and it is a program that I am in full support of. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Just one real quick question. So is there a criteria for the youth to access the programs that you serve and talk about? Is it open to all youth, or is it at-risk youth? I thought I heard you say.
We require a 75% at-risk number, but it depends on the individual programs that we fund. So we have some fairly strict grant guidelines that we work to improve every year. The advisory committee is a volunteer committee, and they take their job very seriously in not only looking at the grant guidelines, but also the grant applications. They're all scored, they're discussed by the committee, and then they're recommended to OICC staff for funding. And many of the programs have, I don't want to call it a closed enrollment, but it is, they're targeted on, say, WIOA qualified eligibility standards. Other programs just open it to everybody. And in my case, when I ran programs, I opened it to everybody because every youth is at risk in some way. And then, based on the applicants and those who were successfully chosen to come into the program, based on their applications and their interview scores, then I figured out how to fund them. Do they qualify for WIA? Do they qualify for the Independent Living Program? Can I fund them through a special funding that's provided by the Forest Service? How do I pay that youth? And typically, the OICC dollars are requested to be used first for wages for the youth. However, if you have those wages covered, then you can talk to OICC staff and get an exception to say, no, we're going to use this for the crew leader, or we need transportation desperately, and this is what we're going to use it for. So there is that flexibility. The great part about OICC, in my mind, is that while we have some set guidelines about the use of the money, you as a program have the flexibility to meet your community needs within your own program as long as the OICC dollars are used under the guidelines.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
And last but not least on this, welcome. Oh.
Thank you,
didn't
Mr.
see
Chair.
You down there, Sal.
That's okay. I'm down here in a corner. Is OICC still... When I was on that advisory board, we were the largest youth employer I believe, in Grant and Sherman County. Are they still doing so?
Chairman Holvey and Representative Esquel, yes. It's my understanding that Grant County will now run 10 crews.
Oh, wow.
In, so about 50 kids or more, depending on the size of the crew in Grant County, which sounds like small numbers, but if you live in such a rural community that you're classified as frontier, this is huge for us. And we face the same issue with employment in Grant County, where most of the jobs that would typically be available to youth, let's use McDonald's as an example, adults take those positions because we are so economically depressed that the adults have to support themselves that way. And so the youth are kind of left out, and so these programs are just huge for us.
Thank you. Now, if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Representative Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Tony Frazier. I am the director of Insight Incorporated. We represent the Workforce Board for Lynn, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. Here today to talk about one of our initiatives called the Career Achievement Network. The Career Achievement Network is a system. It's not a project or a program. It's a system designed to catalyze support in helping the emerging workforce engage in work. It also, one of our aims is to equalize resources. And by that, I mean we've heard a lot about the different resources and nonprofits. We have a lot of nonprofits in our community who engage in trying to help the emerging workforce get into the game. Some of them have great resources. And if I have great resources as a nonprofit, I'm going to do a really good job at preparing my young people to get out there. And if I'm a nonprofit with far less resource, I'm going to do the best job I can and prepare that young person as best I can, send that young person out the door. What employers see across our region is a disparaged level of readiness showing up at the door. We don't have a good means of coordinating that effort to that common outcome that we're looking for. So we're looking to create a regional job-ready standard, especially as it relates to those soft or essential skills that we've been hearing about today, and I'll explain that in a minute. Our initial funding came from CCWD and the Strategic Reserve. It was a total of about $472,000. We're coming to the end of an 18-month run in launching, building out that initiative. We serve young adults ages 16 to 24, as you've heard today, and actually in this initiative, we go to 26. They earn a stipend if they work for a nonprofit through what we like to call meaningful work experience. One example of that is with FoodShare, where former chef Steve Morton, who used to be a restaurant owner here in town, teaches our young people. We've done about six cohorts with the FoodShare, where he is the instructor teaching them food service skills. So they earn a stipend with a nonprofit. They earn a wage, where we engage employers to do paid internships. Those employers match by 50%. And we cover the other 50% of that wage, so we're able to stretch the dollars a little bit in that effort. The Career Achievement Network has three pillars. It's starts off with a 7-week curriculum that utilizes cognitive behavioral techniques to emphasize work-related soft skills. We call it Rethinking Careers, and we're employing that in the four counties now as a coordinated effort to create that regional job-ready standard. And it gets at the notion with young people who have not had a lot of work experience or have had no work experience that, you know, I'm 20-something years old. I think I'm all that in a bag of chips. I want to make big bucks, and I don't want to do the dirty work. I get that response a lot when I say that to employers because that's kind of a mind shift that we need to get at in some way. That's the first pillar. The second pillar is a 200-hour work experience that plays out via businesses and community partners. Again, they get that stipend or that match that I was talking about. The third pillar is an evaluation every 50 hours against industry-requested soft skills. And by that, I mean we engaged, as a workforce board, we engaged what we call a high-performance consortium made up mostly of large manufacturers. We engaged a committee of that consortium. We said, if we were able to get at something that solves this soft skills challenge, would you support it? They said yes. And then we worked with them to develop a tool that actually has 21 soft skill sets. That came up a little bit ago. Our categories that we break that down to is communication, problem solving, and decision making. Because once we can get them to stay off drugs and show up on time, those are the issues that employers really want to see play out on the work floor. The community effort behind it, we have 47 work sites in four counties now that have been created through the collaborative efforts of over 50 business and community partners. This combined community effort increases access to resources such as food, clothing, transportation, and completion of their high school education. One of the things that we find with the demographic that we're reaching out to in terms of showing the opportunities that are available is their first order of business is to try to engage in something that can meet their basic needs, right? So, you know, we often like to talk about education, but when I'm trying to figure out where I'm going to sleep tonight and what I'm going to eat tomorrow, continuing education isn't even on my radar. What I need to do is find a way to earn money so that I can get my feet under me. And that's what the Career Achievement Network aims to do. To date, 189 youth have engaged. 155 of those have entered the system that represent 153 work experience placements, again, playing out in the local community. Some examples of this are how we bring these things together under the Career Achievement Network as the umbrella that catalyzes those resources in support of workforce development, or with our local Chamber of Commerce, who helps us make that local or smaller business connection, our High Performance Consortia, where we engage in some with some of the larger businesses. One of the exciting examples of that is locally with Cabinet Door Service here in town. We've recently launched the Career Achievement Network on their platform. It's the first business program where the young people start at $10 an hour and they complete their 200-hour work experience at 11:20. The way they do their training on that floor, it's a lean operation, lean manufacturing operation. They have six modules in that 200-hour time frame that the young people work through. And I'm excited because it's our first program where the young people actually get raises during the course of their initial 200-hour work experience. The exciting thing about the time that we're in right now is more and more employers are essentially coming out of the woodwork and saying, what do we do to engage? We need to figure out how to expand our worker pipeline. And that's essentially what brought Cabinet Door Service to us because of the turnover that they have. And their mentality is, we build cabinet doors, but we had to shift our thinking. We decided that we are an entry-level workforce trainer that, by the way, gets cabinet doors. And Michael Fowler over there was telling me that once they shifted their thinking in that, their production actually went up because they started focusing resources where they needed to. So with our young people over there, when they complete their 200-hour work experience, he fully intends to hire them. He's going to hire anyway. The exciting thing about this, as we engage those young people, is that as soon as they've worked for him for 6 months, they can now elect to take a company benefit of $2,500 a year per or $2,500 per semester towards anything they want to be educated in. Here's his reasoning behind that. He says, for as long as I've got a young person who's committed to coming for their own cause, I have a dedicated employee, whether that's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years. And that saves them in turnover costs. Mm-hmm. So the Career Achievement Network has become that place to catalyze that type of resource where when we start experiencing our successes with Cabinet Door Service, we'll be sharing this with other employers in the area who may wish to expand their worker pipeline in the same way. A&E Manufacturing up in Yamhill County, we have two young people working up there now who went through the Career Achievement Network, one in a partnership with a local youth program that we fund, YUP, in Yamhill County, McMinnville, and then the Habitat for Humanity, where the youth learned construction trade skills. We had a young lady finish her 200-hour work experience. She's now full-time at ARE Manufacturing. The other young man that is working full-time at ARE, he did his 200-hour work experience under the Career Achievement Network with Alvin there at ARE and moved into full-time employment there. Advantage Precast here locally in Salem, he's had several of our young people and has hired some of them along the way. Other partnerships that we're working on. Next fall, we're going to be starting the Career Achievement Network with the Salem-Keizer School District's Teen Parent Program. I'm also engaged in conversations with Christy Perry about dropout recovery. So when we talk about resources and where those are, workforce boards are charged with aligning resources within the region. And so if we all have a common outcome that we're after, how do we get together and figure out what those resources are? With Christy Perry, we're talking about engaging some of the ADM funding. Now, I gingerly approached her because I was asking her for her money, ADM dollars, and she looked at me and she said, Tony, if we don't re-engage those high school dropouts, I don't even see that money, so I'm not afraid to give it to you, which was a pretty cool way to end that conversation. So, but those are the kinds of things that we can think about as we work to align resources. But we need a mechanism that will catalyze those resources. And what I'm saying is the Career Achievement Network is that mechanism within this region. Another partnership that we're looking at right now is with Kennedy High School up in Mount Angel. They heard about the Career Achievement Network. They invited us up. We've been up there twice now. We're getting ready to do a community evening where we can show that community how they can utilize the Career Achievement Network as a resource to catalyze their resources in their community. He was very excited. The kids are going to get high school credit through the process. They will employ Rethinking Careers curriculum by having some of their teachers trained to teach that curriculum at the Kennedy High School, and they'll use the model in that way. Again, when we talk about how do we align resources, now we're not investing any state or federal dollars there. It's simply the resources that that community is bringing to bear, including 23 employers that want to be involved with those Kennedy High School young people. And one of the real exciting things that's coming about now, I've been working with Johnny Mack over at the community college, and we just had it at first blush here. It looks like we're going to be able to get 6 credits for the work experience wherever it's playing out in the community. And at first blush, it looks like those 6 credits will be able to be applied to any of the CTE programming at Chemeketa Community College. So as you can see, we're reaching out into trying to find every facet, the employers, where can government be most effectively involved, the nonprofits and the school districts and the community colleges. It is a place that is catalyzing resource for workforce development. And one of the things I realize as I go to national conferences is every state in the nation is faced with this challenge right now of engaging those young people. And the state that figures out how to do it best first wins. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate your presentation, all of your presentations. It gives us a good background of some of the other programs that are out there and how we approach youth employment generally. So thank you very much for your presentation this morning. Committee, we're running a little bit behind schedule. I am going to take about a 5-minute break before we start our next section. So we'll recess.
There we go.
And that was back in the old days.
Thank you. I'm going to bring us back into the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. Turn the microphones back on. And we're going to switch gears a little bit. We're going to talk about wage enforcement and misclassification of workers. And up first, we have Rebecca Smith, the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project. Thank you for making the trip. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it. So I am going to talk a little bit about the data on wage theft and misclassification of workers as independent contractors, a little bit about the impact, and a little bit about some models for a robust labor standards enforcement scheme.
And if you could just restate your name for the record, thanks.
My name is Rebecca Smith from the National Employment Law Project. I'm going to use mainly national data, and I'm no expert in what's going on here in Oregon, but you'll tell me which of these great standards you already have, and then we'll hear from Boley and others. So I really wanted to start out with minimum wage. 18 states, more than 30 cities,
including here in Oregon, have increased their minimum wage in the last few years. And that's great. We're making up for some lost value in the minimum wage. We have 42% of U.S. workers who are making less than $15 an hour. And while we really celebrate at NELP the changes in minimum wage, without real robust enforcement of those labor standards, you don't really have a $12 or a $13.50 or a $15 hour minimum wage. And this is just a quick reminder of who are the folks in the country who are making less than $15 an hour, disproportionately women, Black, Latino, and young workers. And why I say we don't have a $15, $13.50, $12, or $10 minimum wage without enforcement is that in 2009, my colleague Annetta Bernhardt and others did a study in three cities, Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York, of about 4,000 low-wage workers. And they did very detailed analysis of the workers' answers to questions about wage theft. And these were the results, that 26% of workers had not been paid minimum wage, over three quarters had not been paid overtime, though they'd worked overtime hours, and 43% had been retaliated against when they complained about it. Now, that's a three-city survey, and it's certainly not Oregon data. That survey has been looked at, what that impact would be nationally, and compared to what property crime reports are nationally. And the results there were that workers are losing up to $20 billion a year in wages from wage theft. And by wage theft, we include failure to pay minimum wage, failure to pay overtime, failure to provide rest breaks, off-the-clock work, and illegal deductions from wages. So a huge difference between what we're losing around the country in property crimes and what we may be losing in wage theft as well. These are national data. I don't expect that Oregon is the same as every other place in the country. But there was a local survey by the Portland District Office of the Department of Labor a couple of years ago in 2014. And they found 79% of restaurants in that area were in violation of the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. And just a little anecdote, I came in last night because I was afraid of Portland traffic, and I was talking to the desk clerk, and she asked me what I was doing here today, and I told her, and she said, oh, that happened to me. In my last job, I wasn't paid for overtime, and I'm still struggling to try and get it back. And I said, oh, that's terrible. That happens to a lot of people. And she said, yeah, and it happened to my son. In his last job at a fast food place, he wasn't paid his wages. So it happens, and it happens more than we would perhaps like to think about. So another aspect that you all wanted to hear about of wage theft is calling workers independent contractors instead of employees when they properly should be considered employees. And it happens in virtually every industry. We focus on low-wage industries, but construction, janitorial, technology, transportation, home care, cable installers. There is litigation and findings in all of those places. There is data showing high rates of misclassification in most of them. So why we think of misclassification as wage theft is that workers who are treated as independent contractors aren't, at least according to their employers, entitled to any of those things that I talked about earlier. You don't get minimum wage and overtime if you're not an employee. You're not entitled to workers' compensation, or you have to cover yourself in some states. You don't get unemployment insurance if you lose a job. You aren't covered by discrimination laws. And, of course, you can't join a union and collectively bargain. You don't get any retirement benefits. What's the cost to workers of misclassification? the worker pays the entire employer and employee side of federal taxes, so that's about 15.3%. If you're if you know how to do it, you can get half of that back in your taxes, unlike my graduate student's son who calls me every year and says, oh my gosh, what do I do? But many people don't do that, and the companies, of course, aren't paying into Social Security if they are treating workers as independent contractors. The worker who is injured on the job is must pay their own costs or rely on publicly funded health care to cover their injuries. And then workers are responsible for all of their own operating costs as well, if they're treated as independent contractors. So a lot is at stake for workers who are treated as independent contractors. But it's not just workers who lose when we have theft of wages or employers misclassify workers as independent contractors. Of course, states are losing out on workers' compensation, unemployment insurance premiums. The feds are missing out, as I said before, on federal payroll taxes. And then law-abiding employers are losing the opportunity to compete fairly. So if you're trying to get a public contract, you're going to get underbid. And if you're just trying to compete in the marketplace, you're going to be underbid. So why does this non-payment of wages persist? I think there's really about four different reasons, and you could probably tell me more. Resources is one. The U.S. Department of Labor has 1,000 investigators covering 7 million businesses and 100 million employers across the country. And I'm sure we'll hear from Boley about what the ratio is for them. As I said, workers are very vulnerable as well. From our study, 43% of workers who complained were retaliated against. And as back in the day when I used to actually practice law, I can tell you that nearly every time I called an employer who needed to pay a worker their wages, I would be told that, well, that guy's gone or that woman is gone. That's especially a problem for immigrant workers who make up a disproportionate share of low-wage workers who might not know their rights, might have trouble speaking English, might have fear of deportation, and in probably the worst cases, workers might be trafficked. They're not going to come forward and complain if their wages are stolen. The third is this question of who's the boss, and that addresses misclassification, or is meant to suggest the issue of misclassification, and also when employers are subcontracting jobs and using staffing agencies or other kinds of subcontracting arrangements. Sometimes it's really confusing to workers where they should go if they're injured on the job or if they have not been paid their wages. And then in many cases, the laws are just not strong enough to actually deter wage theft. So an employer might look more like an interest-free loan for an employer to fail to pay wages. Even if they're caught, it may be months and months and months before they have to pay. And in some states, there won't even really be penalties. So what's happening? There has been a lot of activity around misclassification in particular, but around wage theft itself across the country in the last several years. And I think you're going to hear a little bit about the U.S. Department of Labor's initiatives with states. The Department of Labor also put out an interpretation of the Fair Labor Standards Act and what it means to be an employer this summer that I hope will be some guidance to employers who want to be complying with the law. You can see here the number of states, or at least I hope you can. The green is those that have task forces to address misclassification. The blue are those that have a strong definition of who is an employer, the ABC test that I'll talk about a little bit. And then some states have been passing sector-specific laws, especially in construction. So what are the key pieces to what we think is a robust wage enforcement system? I'm going to go through about six different factors here or provisions, and I think that you have some of them already in Oregon. The first is this question of definition of who is an employer under your law. And the best definitions are the ABC test, which appears in a lot of workers' comp and unemployment insurance statutes. And the ABC test is a question of control by the employer of the worker's work, whether the worker is employed in the usual course of business for the business, and whether the worker has actually established an independent business, which is really the hallmark of someone who is not an employee. They have their own business. And then the joint employer question that I alluded to earlier, strong indication of who is a joint employer and jointly liable to workers, the staffing company and the host company, for example, or a general contractor and a subcontractor. Second is protection against retaliation. And here the best law, I think, around the country is in California, which has very strong protection against retaliation, in particular for immigrant workers. And then the question of compensating worker for violations and deterring future violations. The best sort of compensation schemes have either daily penalties or treble damages, and there are advantages and disadvantages to each of those. But the bottom line is you want workers to be compensated for their lost wages, also for the time and trouble of having to go after their lost wages. And in many cases, there are real financial consequences to workers who haven't been paid wages that are owed as well. Rent that's late, bills that go unpaid and require late fees. And of course, in the worst cases, you lose your car or you lose your house. And so you want to be able to compensate workers. You want to be able to ensure that businesses comply in the future. About 30 states, and I believe Oregon is one of them, have criminal penalties as well for wage theft. I'm not a huge fan of criminal penalties because I think it's very hard to orient prosecutors and police to be able to add this to their plate. But there have been some pretty high-level enforcement actions in New York and in L.A. that have, you know, got the attention of particular industries like car wash and made a difference, I think, in terms of compliance for those folks. So other key components. I think it's a all-hands-on-deck kind of situation where you want to ensure that you have adequate public enforcement, but you also want to be able to count on private enforcement. So you need to adequately fund your public enforcement. That addresses the resources question that I mentioned earlier. Seattle, where I work, is considering now a one penny per hour surcharge on the business fee in order to fund enforcement in that state. Or in that city, and we'll see how that goes before our city council at this moment. But if you think of the things that a public enforcement team needs to do, they have to be able to issue rules and regulations, they have to conduct thorough investigations, they have to do outreach and education, they have to be able to resolve complaints in a timely way so workers aren't losing their car. They have to be able to, of course, recover the wages, develop some programs to ensure that employers know the law and comply with it as well. And they should be able to collect and analyze the data so they can see what kind of impact they're having. All those things cost money.
Private enforcement as well has an important role to play, and the best way to encourage private enforcement through attorneys anyway is to make sure that attorneys' fees can be collected. In about 40 states, attorneys' fees are available to the prevailing plaintiff in a case. Something that's gotten a lot of attention recently is the idea of community partnerships. And again, Seattle has funded community groups at $1 million for community outreach. And if you think about it this way, community folks speak the languages that workers speak in their communities. You can't really expect a public agency to speak every language that people who might be vulnerable speak. They are based in the community, so they're in a position to know what's going on in their communities. They have the trust of community members already, and so that can deal with some of the retaliation issues. And we've just started this project of actually funding community partnerships in Seattle. So we'll see how that goes in the next couple of years. But San Francisco has been doing it for, I think, it's about a decade. And they have about $500,000 that goes to community groups. Los Angeles is also considering funding community groups. Even if you don't fund community groups, creating those partnerships between enforcement agencies and community groups, I think, is key. And the other thing that community groups can do is kind of do some triage. When I hear from the groups in Seattle who have the contracts, they say, you know what, we kind of saved the agency from investigating some things because we do the work, and it doesn't have to go to the agency at that moment. Finally, really guaranteeing that collection is actually possible. There was a study that we worked on in California that found that even after workers had been found to have wages owing, only about 17% of them were able to collect. So there are a couple of things that you can do to ensure that there's actually money there for workers to claim against. The first is wage liens, so a claim against the property of a business that ensures that wages are paid. And those exist in a number of states across the country. Wisconsin is a good model, I think, there. And the second is guaranteeing collection through wage bonding. And California has some wage bonding provisions. They've had them in a number of industries for a few years, and now they have a broader wage bonding provision that requires employers who have failed to pay in the past to post a bond of between about $50,000 and $150,000 in order to continue in business. So I am happy to answer any questions that you have. We have Nell puts out a lot of paper, so there's a long list of things for folks to take a look at here, but we're happy to answer your questions and be helpful to you as well.
Representative Nose.
I have two questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you. First,
we'll start with one.
Okay. How is it that employers are able to avoid paying the minimum wage?
Because they don't get caught.
They just don't. I mean, they just literally, whatever they put in their payroll processing, they just put a lower amount, and then they...
Right. I mean, oftentimes it is that workers are working off the clock. So they're there for training meetings, or they work through lunch, or they work an hour later. Employers say, clock in, you know, after you've gotten the business ready to be opened in the morning.
Okay. That makes... All right. And then my second question is, which sectors do you think that that is... Where is that the most significant?
There are, at least from our study, retail was a huge problem. We've see that fast food and restaurant is a huge problem. There was a recent study of restaurant workers, and I'm trying to think what the geography was, that found about 90% of fast food workers were suffering some kind of wage theft. In our study, home health, about three-quarters of folks weren't being paid overtime. Food preparation, about 75% off the clock, as I mentioned.
waiters and cafeteria workers, 85% not getting rest breaks or meal breaks. And that's actually another function that community partnerships can do, is help target. There's a lot of discussion about directed investigations. So an agency being able to not just rely on complaints, but think about where the violations are going to be more prevalent and doing investigations in those places. And that addresses this issue of the vulnerability of the workers who are just not going to come forward, especially immigrant workers and, in the worst case, trafficked workers.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, a question?
Yeah, on the contractor bit, do you find that there are some employees that want to be contractors, or is it more the employer doesn't want to mess with the payroll and all of the other parts of being an employer, and so he just contracts out? But then the contractor themselves, do they more or less desire to be like that so that they may make more and then they don't pay their taxes?
We see more that the employer says, hey, you're going to be an independent contractor, and often workers don't quite even know what that is. I have something that comes to mind is the litigation against Uber in California, and Uber had presented, I think, something like 600 declarations from workers who said, we want to be independent contractors. But when the workers learned that that meant that all the things they were giving up, a number of them who, were able to be interviewed, not everybody was, said, oh, wait, we would much rather be employees. If we get injured, we get workers' compensation. Mm-hmm. Someone's paying into our Social Security. That makes a big difference.
Somebody covers my insurance. Yeah.
Thank you. I this is a really good jumping off point for us, and a good presentation to kind of, talk about the issue. It'll be interesting to see, where Oregon falls within all of this.
Great.
I was noting that 40 states have prevailing plaintiff awards.
Yes.
For private attorneys to take labor actions. I don't think Oregon is one of those. But we'll find out next.
You're going to find out soon.
So,
and we are absolutely ready to be helpful on this, as I know you have local organizations that are also ready to help. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Up next, we're going to listen to our government agencies that are responsible for wage enforcement. They're going to talk about the Interagency Compliance Network, David Gerstenfeld, John Galvin, and Gerhard Teubel. Did I get it right that time? Thank you, gentlemen, and though I know you were prepped for 15 minutes apiece, we're going to shoot for 10, so I know that will hurt your feelings dramatically, but maybe you can come back someday. We'll see how it goes.
Thank you. Chair Holby, members of the committee, for the record, David Gerstenfeld, Division Director with the Employment Department overseeing the Unemployment Insurance Program.
Gerhard Teubel, Administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries.
John Galvin with the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. We're going to talk about what Oregon does with misclassification, and I think you heard a good summary of what some of the impacts are. There are real incentives for businesses to have workers called independent contractors. There are expenses that they don't have to pay. The flip side of that is that the programs that those are going to, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, retirement plans, that those programs then are not there for the workers. So I think you heard a good summary, and to try to get down to 10 minutes, I won't belabor those points. I will talk a little bit, though, about some of the challenges that we have as a system looking at misclassification. One is that there is no one agency that is responsible for determining employee or independent contractor. Hmm. And I heard Karen earlier say that about the youth employment, and it's a similar situation here where a lot of different agencies, that's a core part of what we look at, but there's not one overarching entity that decides that for all the programs. Partially because of that, I think there's no dedicated funding for the ICN, the Interagency Compliance Network. Instead, the member agencies participate in that group, but really are using their existing resources to do that enforcement and cooperation work. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the history of the issue here in Oregon. And one of the challenges that we have is that there is not one definition for who's an employee and who's an independent contractor. The trend over time has been to try to get to fewer definitions, but there are still multiple definitions in use. And it's really difficult to come up with one definition that works well, not just for all of the different programs that our agencies enforce, but also for all the different businesses and industries across the state. So trying to get one really simple to answer test for all those possible situations is difficult. So going back to 1989, in Oregon, there was a statute created that tried to start to address that, so 670-600. It took what had been more tests and tests that were much less of what we call bright line, and tried to make it a more discrete test where it was easier for people to look at the situation and decide if they were an employee or an independent contractor, and to start to narrow down the number of different definitions that are out there. Over time, there has been other legislative action, so that step was taken, and then shortly later, the workers' compensation program was found not to actually be covered by that common definition, so it wasn't quite as consolidated as we thought. Moving on, in 2003, there was what I think is the precursor to the ICN was formed, the Independent Contractor Task Force, to really look at the issue about independent contractors. And over time, that group did a number of things, including adopting a rule that became effective at the beginning of 2007. It was a rule that clarified the independent contractor statute and definitions for five different agencies. So again, focusing on that theme of trying to get fewer definitions and more coordination. And those agencies were the Landscape Contractors Board, Construction Contractors Board, Department of Consumer and Business Services, Department of Revenue, and the Employment Department. One of the big barriers that this group had to trying to coordinate their efforts were some of the very strict confidentiality laws. The Department of Revenue specifically had very strict confidentiality. We're going out looking at employee wage records, business records, so it is important that we keep things confidential. Over time, that was addressed, and that's not really a barrier at this point. One of the goals of this Independent Contractor Task Force was they created a compliance network, which is a voluntary group of agencies that got together to coordinate on the audits, and that was both to be more consistent as agencies and also to avoid the situation of one business having four different enforcement agencies show up at different times over the course of a year looking at fundamentally the same question of are these people employees or not. There was some legislation in 2011 that clarified the confidentiality issues. It said that when the ICN meets, they are not public meetings, and that was important so that when we're talking about confidential payroll situations or discussing agency enforcement strategies, that we can have the appropriate level of confidentiality there. There was also a proposal that did not pass that would have looked at the multiple appeal paths. So I've mentioned there are lots of different agencies, lots of different definitions. I think when we were preparing for this, off the top of our heads, we came up with four different appeal routes, depending on which agency and which program is involved, where there's a potential for a business to challenge an agency's decision about whether someone is an employee or an independent contractor. So there's a legislative attempt to address that. It did not pass, and that's one of the kind of remaining challenging issues that we're working on.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me. For the record, my name is John Galvin. I'm the Withholding and Payroll Tax Section Manager at the Department of Revenue. I've been actively involved with both the Steering Committee and the Enforcement Committee of the Interagency Compliance Network since 2009. We'd first like to express our appreciation to Representative Holvey for his continued support and dedication of the Interagency Compliance Network, and recognize that his commitment to the ICN isn't unnoticed. So the Interagency Compliance Network is a group of seven agencies that work together to improve compliance with tax and employment laws. Whether somebody is considered an employee or independent contractor has significant ramifications, as you've heard a little bit about this morning. For businesses, if somebody is an independent contractor, it means lower operating costs because they don't have to pay the cost associated with having employees, including workers' compensation and payroll taxes. For individuals, it impacts whether the taxes are withheld from their paychecks, whether they're entitled to receive minimum wage, whether they have insurance protection if they're injured on the job, and whether or not they may receive unemployment insurance benefits if they become unemployed. Many agencies are impacted by independent contractor status. The objective of our interagency compliance network is to create a level playing field for businesses. Employers who misclassify employees as independent contractors save nearly $5 for every $100 of payroll, which allows those businesses to operate with lower expenses and creates an unlevel playing field. Worker misclassification contributes to underfunded worker benefits, tax avoidance, unfair wage practices, and it puts businesses and individuals who obey the law at a disadvantage. We focus our efforts in four areas: communication, including education and outreach, sharing and analyzing data amongst the seven agencies, coordinating compliance efforts, and investigating criminal activity related to worker classification. Because sharing tax information is so important to the agencies, the Employment Department and the Department of Revenue worked with the Internal Revenue Service and were successful in an agreement that allows us to share federal tax information. So that's been big for us. While there is not permanent funding for the Interagency Compliance Network, the agencies use their existing resources to coordinate with each other and enforce the various worker protection and related laws. In 2010, the Emergency Board released one-time funds to the Interagency Compliance Network to fund temporary staff, legal services, and website improvements based on an action plan developed by the participating agencies. A portion of that funding was allocated to the Bureau of Labor and Industries to establish a full-time, limited-duration position to help develop and maintain a website. Because there was no additional funding, the position ended at the end of June 2011, and as a result, the Department of Employment maintains the website, but they do not receive any dedicated funding for that effort. The Employment Department has received federal grant funding totaling over $1 million in the past few years, and that funding has helped focus on additional outreach to employers regarding misclassification, along with additional staff and tools for more enforcement. Obtaining dedicated funding for the Interagency Compliance Network will allow for additional enforcement efforts for member agencies with less impact to daily operations. Education outreach program. The goal of our education and these presentations is to make it as easy as possible for businesses to understand and comply with the law. You can see in the chart that the ICN agencies work together in these public outreach events. Our presentations are largely geared at worker classification, but they also include information regarding basic payroll compliance. In 2015, the Department of Revenue participated in 116 outreach events, and we have an additional 56 scheduled for 2016. These outreach events are conducted all around the state, and some of our stakeholders have included the Oregon Business Fairs, multiple chambers of commerce, Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, and small business development centers. Whenever in-person participation is not possible from all of the agencies and they're not able to attend, their materials are provided to the other agencies for distribution. This has led to strong working relationships between the agencies and better customer service for those taxpayers seeking the information.
And John did mention the website that Boley had maintained and that that duty has shifted to the Employment Department. Because we lost that dedicated resource that was really focused on that, over time the website did get less helpful, we think, for the public. So as the law changed, as new issues came up, as state standards for our websites changed, it was difficult to maintain. We did this year release a new version of the website, which we think is easier to navigate, more helpful to the public. That was done with all of the ICN member agencies participating. That is a challenge, to have seven agencies coordinate on jointly maintaining a website. We're putting together a communication group from the ICN with the goal that that group will take on that long-term maintenance and upkeep. So it's something that hopefully will not get as dated and we'll be able to maintain a little more frequently. One of the things that the Employment Department is looking at to add as a resource to this page in the not-too-distant future is putting up some redacted versions of some of the hearing decisions that come out about unemployment insurance tax issues, and a lot of those do deal with independent contractor versus employee. So we think that could be a good resource for the public.
As was mentioned earlier, the ICN is the Interagency Compliance Network. It is really comprised of two groups. At a higher level is the Steering Committee, which gives general direction to the Enforcement Work Group, which I'll discuss now. The Enforcement Work Group is made up of representatives from all of the member agencies of the ICN. This work group meets monthly. This is really where the nuts and bolts work of what the ICN does happens. The representatives from the various agencies take this opportunity to share information with one another about issues that may have arisen within their own agencies. This could be misclassification related. It could be related to the cash economy or the underground economy and information that any of the agencies might be receiving, tips of this nature where the group as a whole might want to dedicate some resources and some focus. It is also here with the enforcement work group that the joint audits are planned. Resources for how to plan a joint audit or when to audit jointly usually come out of the kind of information that the representatives present at these meetings. The group tries to use data that's available to the member agencies and which, you know, show that perhaps there's something going on with a particular employer or in a particular industry. For example, if employers for many years have been submitting W-2s for employees and then all of a sudden they switch to submitting 1099s for contractors, that may mean that there's been some kind of switch in the business model that may be appropriate or may not be appropriate. And that is sort of a flag for the member agencies that they may wish to look at that issue more closely. In the past, there have been challenges with using data. Some of the data that we receive is from the federal government, and so, as has been mentioned, there's limitations on how that can be utilized, and that has slowed potential audits, but we believe that these issues have been surmounted, and for that reason, we expect that the number of audits in the next year will increase to at least 52 between the Employment Department and the Revenue Department auditors, covering a gross payroll probably between $65 to $94 million.
These results displayed here are actually the audits specifically done by the Interagency Compliance Network auditors. The Interagency Compliance Network audits, they're more complex and take longer than a regular compliance audit. The auditors are auditing for both the Employment Department and the Department of Revenue at the same time, which allows the business to provide the information to both agencies during a single audit rather than being subjected to multiple audits for the same time period. These audits have a history of being appealed, which leads to a tremendous amount of work, additional work for those auditors, and it doesn't allow them to complete as many audits. However, these audits are effective. of the businesses that were audited by the ICN auditors that are still open in 2015, more than 80% of those filed voluntarily for the following four quarters and reported more than $1 million in 2015. Referrals that are not audited by the ICN auditors can still involve collaborative efforts between the agencies. As Gerhard mentioned, the enforcement groups meets monthly, and they share the way they identify leads, specific case detail, and support each other in criminal investigation of businesses or individuals suspected in classification errors. The next slide. The agencies in the ICN continue to conduct investigations and compliance audits outside of the Interagency Compliance Network. These audits are typically not conducted jointly. However, the Oregon Department of Revenue and the Department of Employment share audit results anytime a change is made to the information originally provided by the employer. The compliance staff at the Department of Revenue investigate multiple non-compliant scenarios, including withholding tax being deducted and not reported, underreported payroll or paying cash or under the table, underreported wages that have been earned within the transit districts, and classification of workers. Since 2012, the Department of Revenue has conducted over 7,000 field investigations, with more than 1,800 of those coming directly from the Employment Department referrals. These investigations resulted in approximately $188 million in underreported wages, $15 million in withholding tax assessments, and $6 million in transit tax assessed. David will now share information regarding the Oregon Employment Department compliance audits outside of the ICN.
Thank you. And again, as John did with the revenue ones, these results up on the screen are the results just for our general auditors. We do have what we refer to as super auditors that do the ICN audits. So these are the traditional audits, but a lot of these do come from that cooperation at the enforcement group level. To give a little bit of context also for first quarter this year so far, the Employment Department has found 895 misclassified workers and found $332,800 in unpaid unemployment taxes. That was through these regular audits. The ICN-specific audits during that first quarter of this year resulted in another 92 misclassified workers being identified and another $220,000 in unpaid unemployment insurance taxes. I'll echo what John said, that on some of these ICN audits tend to be the more complex one with more workers involved and more money at stake, so they tend to be more contentious and are more likely to be appealed and to take longer and to take more resources to go through. Most of the audits that the Employment Department does when we're looking at whether the unemployment insurance taxes were paid, we have a few different ways that we decide who to audit. Some of those are done randomly, and that's a requirement of the federal government for the unemployment insurance program. Frequently, we will start looking if we have someone that tries to get unemployment insurance benefits, and they tell us that they worked for a particular employer, and when we check our records, that employer never reported paying wages to the person or reported much less in wages having been paid. So that's a sign for us that we may need to go audit. And then in conjunction with our ICM partner agencies, we also look at, are there particular industries or business models where we think that there might be emerging trends or compliance challenges where we need to be more active, both to have a deterrent effect and also to educate businesses that may not understand how to properly classify their workers.
But not all of the enforcement activities that the ICN group undertakes or that the ICN member groups undertake are audits. The group regularly coordinates on sweeps throughout the state of Oregon. In 2015, nine such sweeps were conducted in various parts of the state. This is when multiple agencies get together and converge on a particular geographic region or look at employers in a particular industry. For example, a construction sweep, or the agencies might go down together to a construction site and really talk to the businesses that are found there, talk to the workers that are there, and try to assess what the level of compliance is within those particular businesses. These have been successful in the past. I think in 2015, nearly 800 businesses were contacted in this way. Agency representatives interviewed more than 1,000 workers to talk to them about the issues on the workplace. And as a result of those sweeps, about 91 employers were found to be not in compliance with some state law that was enforced by one of these agencies. The ICN also has regular contact with DOJ, which is part of the ICN group. DOJ becomes involved when there are legal cases that the group wishes to pursue that require representation. Currently, there's DOJ is representing the ICN on a multi-million dollar joint audit that happened with the Department of Revenue and the Oregon Employment Department. Other agencies also undertake different sort of educational type of goals for themselves in order to help with the misclassification issue. For example, CCB has produced a video which shows or displays what the risks of paying employees in cash are. I know that Boley and some of the site visits it has done has come across workers in construction who are paid in cash and has followed up on those kinds of issues. Earlier it was mentioned that not all of the member agencies operate under the same definition of what is an employee or what is an employer, and Boley is one of those agencies. Unlike the Revenue Department or the Employment Department, we don't have a statutory definition of what an independent contractor is. Mm-hmm. What we do follow is the federal regulations and case law around what it means to be suffered or permitted to work. And so the test that we apply, and this is a test that the courts around the country have used in assessing employment under Federal Labor Standards Act cases, is what's called the economic realities test. And that test basically establishes six criteria, and the goal is to assess on a spectrum whether a worker is more like an employee or is more like an independent contractor. And so it's looking at various factors that would determine that. For example, the extent to which work performed by the worker is an integral part of the alleged employer's business, the degree of control exercised by the alleged employer, the permanency of the relationship between the worker and the business, the skill and initiative required to perform the work, the degree to which the worker's opportunity for profit and loss is determined by the alleged employer, and the extent of the relative investments of the worker and the alleged employer. And none of these factors are looked at singly, or no single factor is determinative. You have to look at it on a holistic basis as a whole, and like I said before, to determine on that spectrum, is the work more like that performed by an employee or as an independent contractor? Foley regularly works with the U.S. Department of Labor on various kinds of issues. We recently signed a partnership agreement with that organization. The USDOL does have an ongoing initiative around misclassification, and we anticipate that USDOL will be able to help us and provide us with information to further our efforts in that area. The agreement is not restricted to investigations of that kind, however. We certainly would look at other issues, for example, again, the cash economy or underground economy, and just general issues of the non-payment of wages. I think a point I would like to make: under the wage and hour regulations, misclassification by itself is not a violation of the wage and hour regulations, but it oftentimes precipitates violations of the wage and hour regulations. And usually where we see it in the wage and hour division is that when a worker has been misclassified, there's probably minimum wage issues or overtime issues or record-keeping issues or working condition issues like rest periods and meal periods that are not being provided. And that's where we then insert ourselves. So we do look for ways not only to partner with other state agencies, but also with our federal colleagues in addressing this important issue.
So So some of the challenges that the ICN agencies face, there's discussion about the cash payments, and the impact on workers and on businesses is really the same for these cash payments, sometimes made under the table without deductions being made, as it is for misclassification. They're typically harder to investigate because there's less of a paper trail. One of the issues that's come up is with legalized recreational marijuana. Those businesses are largely blocked out of the formal banking system and are required to do a lot of cash transactions. So that's something that we're looking at, trying to do educational outreach to keep an eye on that, to make sure that people understand that even when you're paying cash, you still have to make sure to do the same deductions, send the taxes in, make sure that people are being reported correctly so that those workers do have the various protections. Another issue that is being looked at is what we call the gig economy, and this is, it's a broad spectrum of business models where a business essentially tries to take the consumer who's looking for some sort of service, whether it's delivery of themselves somewhere else through a rideshare type situation, or it's delivery of food from restaurants, provision of some kind of professional service, try to link that end user, the customer, with someone who's providing that service. This is being done in a lot of different ways, and depending on how it's done, sometimes there's a lot of control exerted over the person providing the service. Sometimes there's very little control. And because this is an emerging business model, this is something of interest to us to make sure that those businesses know where the various programs think that they have become an employer, and where the people are actually independent contractors. So we're anticipating some ongoing issues with that, working with businesses as those issues come up. Another challenge is one of the themes throughout this presentation, which is the definitions. So we've talked about how there's been this effort to try to create fewer definitions, more bright line definitions. We have been successful partially in that in Oregon, but that statute that has the independent contractor definition, that is relatively bright line. There was some case law that did make the lines a little bit blurrier. So it's no longer quite as much of a bright line. At the same time, and I think Gerhard pointed this out, there's not really a way for us as a state to create one absolutely uniform definition that would work for everything without some state programs then no longer being consistent with their federal counterparts. So that's a challenge both for enforcement and then also for educating the businesses so that they understand how things work. At the same time, there have been legislative proposals nationally and in Oregon, some of which have passed, some of which have not, to create more exceptions from the definition of employee. Some of those are very narrow. Some of them are much broader. I think a number of those have come before this committee in prior sessions. And that is something that, again, that in terms of enforcement and education just makes it a little bit more challenging when we already have these multiple definitions and then we're taking someone that fits within them and carving out an exception, sometimes for some very specific circumstances. In terms of future steps, the Employment Department is using our business intelligence tool that lets us look at data in a more refined way to try to best identify those businesses, those industries where we think we should do more outreach. So that's something that we're sharing the results of that with the ICN so that we can best target what industries and business models and individual businesses may be most effective for us to go out and look at. We're still working on that single appeal path problem. That one is very challenging. There are multiple courts, multiple hearings processes. Businesses don't always agree. The tax preparers and attorneys don't always agree. So we're exploring some possibilities for potential pilot projects. We may run into the same barriers that have been run into in the past, both with legislative proposals and prior efforts of the ICN, but we thought that it was worth taking another look at. So we are continuing that work. We're continuing to try to find ways to best describe those statutory exemptions and to make it clear to businesses and workers, are they an employee or are they an independent contractor, and how does that fit under the various programs? And then finally, trying to expand the involvement with more non-ICN agencies. We've been very successful with this with a lot of the outreach and education. So the Secretary of State's office, for instance, has a small business ombudsman. We're very engaged with them to help push information out and to get questions referred to us. And we're also looking at ways to involve non-ICN agencies when appropriate with some of the enforcement work. And I think that's kind of our overview. Hopefully we condensed it enough without skipping important things, and we're certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Just one question. It's always troubling to hear that we have different definitions, and we're always trying to, you know, give business the correct information. And clearly when some businesses operate one way and some businesses operate another, it's not really fair to businesses who are using paying taxes and a whole payroll system and somebody who's competing with them who does not.
As the inconsistency with the definitions being a problem, is that a problem that Oregon can solve, or is that a problem with the IRS versus the U.S. Department of Labor, and it just sort of trickles down to us because there's, I'm trying to figure out who, you know, how do you reconcile that when you have an agency that is saying you're an independent or you're not an independent contractor, and then you go to the tax court, and the tax court says, hey, you're an independent contractor. So what happens when is that just the realm of the court? And
Chair Holby, I think there's two aspects to that. One is that single appeal path that could partially help to narrow down getting conflicting decisions. I think the bigger issue is really just which definitions apply. And Oregon, I think, could make the policy decision to apply a uniform definition across all programs. From the business perspective, I don't think that answers the question, though, because then we would be saying, for all state programs, here is the test. However, for instance, as Gerhard said, for wage and hour purposes, we might use this test that would be uniform with all of the other state programs. But in doing that, we would be now using a different test than the federal government uses for its wage and hour enforcement. So Oregon cannot by itself create a single definition for all Oregon businesses to use across all programs, because there's both the different programs within the state, but also the federal and state level of enforcement.
I guess to follow up, does the IRS have the same definition as the U.S. Department of Labor?
The Internal Revenue Service, I believe, uses a 20-factor test. The Department of Labor uses the economic realities test that Gerhard mentioned for wage and hour purposes. The Department of Labor also oversees the unemployment insurance program, does not have its own mandated definition, but there are typically three types of definitions that can apply to the unemployment insurance. So things are not consistent across the federal programs at the national level.
Great.
Beretto. David, does the if you're an independent contractor, are you required to get workers' comp as a sole proprietor? Do you get that on yourself? Or?
Chair Hovey, Representative Beretto, I am not a workers' compensation expert. I believe if the person is actually an independent contractor, they are not required to be covered by the businesses who we would otherwise say was the employer.
Right.
If you are an independent contractor and you're your own business, I believe that you can go out into the marketplace and purchase that, but I don't know that there's the same...
But you're not required.
Correct, and I don't think there's the same regulatory enforcement and maybe not all the same procedures if you are injured.
Right. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Looks like the committee's just about done.
Oh, my gosh.
And I appreciate you gentlemen being here and giving us a little background on wage compliance and the ICN, and I'm sure we'll be following up with more conversations in the future. So with that, thank you gentlemen, and thank you Representative Beretto and committee that's not here, that was here. We're going to adjourn the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor.
Hey Paul, I'm going to give you this. This is